You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, takes on the world news.
This is Jeff Blankford, welcoming you to the April 13th edition of Takes on the World. A public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners. In the midst of the seemingly endless stomach-turning election season, we have heard a lot from the candidates, if the voters give them the opportunity, how hard they will come down on the Islamic State or ISIS once they're given the keys to the Oval Office. One would think from their statements, particularly those of the Republicans, that the Islamic State's the greatest terrorist threat to the world and, well, the world's ever faced. If so, one might have expected that they, as well as the American media, would welcome its recent defeat in the ancient Syrian city of Palmyra by government troops backed by Russian airstrikes. Not so. As it turned out, their antagonism toward Vladimir Putin and Russia trumps their concern about ISIS. Either the retaking of this ancient Syrian city with its famous ruins by the troops of Bashar al-Assad with Mr. Putin's help was ignored or treated as a mixed blessing, as exemplified in a news report by NPR the following Monday, which described the town as being held by ISIL, quote, before it fell back into government hands last weekend, end quote. That comment, which I also heard in offhand manner in which that historic defeat of ISIS was viewed by America's political class, spurred author and anthropologist Barbara Nimre Aziz to pen an article for the Daily Counterpunch website entitled An Impossible Syrian Victory. At 25 minutes past the hour, I'll be speaking with her about the failings of U.S. media coverage of the war in Syria, where she once taught and spent a number of years. So stay tuned for that. The biggest story to break since my last program was the release by the German newspaper Süddeutsche Zeitung of what are being called the Panama Papers, the result of a collective effort by a consortium of international journalists. They contain the names of more than 11 million non-Panamanians who opened shell accounts through the Panamanian law office of Mossack and Fonseca in order to conceal funds from would-be tax collectors and prying publics. The list appears to be a who's who of corporation heads representing virtually every country, every continent, and some of their close friends. The first to make the headlines is British Prime Minister David Cameron, whose wealthy father had apparently used a law firm to keep an investment fund hidden from public sight. Cameron's first response was to deny the existence of the fund and sharply criticize what he called, quote, the deeply hurtful and profoundly untrue allegations, end quote. By the end of the week, he was acknowledging that he and his wife Samantha owned shares in an offshore fund, Blairmore Holdings, set up by his late father, before he said selling it for £30,000 in 2010, so he claimed. One of the more interesting figures caught up in the scandal is Ukraine's pro-Western president, the oligarch Petro Poroshenko, who has found himself in a political storm over the leaked documents from the Panamanian firm showing him having holdings he claimed to have gotten rid of. Critics of Vladimir Putin have tried to rope him into the scandal, despite his name not showing up in any account. Robert Perry of Consortium News, a frequent guest on the program, pointed out that, quote, the new anti-Putin allegations, ballyhooed by the UK Guardian and other outlets, and particularly noteworthy because the so-called Panama Papers that supposedly implicate him in offshore financial dealings never mention his name. Or, as the Guardian writes, quotes, though the president's name does not appear in any of the records, the data reveals a pattern. His friends have earned millions from deals that seemingly could not have been secure without his patronage. The documents suggest Putin's family has benefited from this money. His friends' fortunes appear his to spend, end quote. None, if you will, writes Parry, the lack of specificity and the reliance on speculation, a pattern seemingly suggests appear. Indeed, if Putin were not already a demonized figure in the Western media, such phrasing would never pass an editor's computer screen. Indeed, notes Perry, the only point made in the declarative phrasing is that, quote, the president's name does not appear in any of the records, end quote. The Panama Papers scandal came as no surprise to the folks at Public Citizen. In 2009, they issued a paper warning that the U.S. Free Trade Agreement with Panama, a leftover from the Bush administration, would be the vehicle which shady bankers, businessmen, and drug lords would continue to use or set up new shell accounts, since the country carved out of Colombia at the time of the opening of the Panama Canal was already being used as a tax haven. Citizens United paper said it all, quote, the title of it, Panama FTA would undermine U.S. efforts to stop offshore tax haven abuse and regulate risk, end quote. Its executive summary began with a promise from newly elected President Barack Obama in a speech to Congress on February 24, 2009. Quote, "We will restore a sense of fairness and balance to our tax code by finally ending the tax breaks for corporations that ship our jobs overseas," end quote. Despite opposition from unions and many House Democrats, President Obama and then-Secretary of State Hillary Clinton both sold the FTA to Panama as fixing the Panama tax haven security secrecy issue. Thanks to the leadership of Panama, President Martinelli, said Obama at the time, there have been a change of significant reforms in banking and taxation in Panama, and we are confident now that a free trade agreement would be good for our country, end quote. Secretary of State Clinton chimed in, according to Reuters, saying that Washington hoped to enact two long-delayed free trade agreements with Colombia and Panama. Quote, "We are making great progress in both agreements," she said, noting they included steps to guarantee labor rights in Colombia and ensure tax transparency in Panama that will help win U.S. lawmakers' approval of the trade deals, end quote. Senator Bernie Sanders said at the time that Panama was a world leader when it came to allowing wealthy Americans and large corporations to evade U.S. taxes by stashing their cash in offshore tax havens. The Panama Free Trade Agreement, he said at the time, will make this bad situation much worse. Speaking of trade and trade deficits, which have been bandied about by our presidential candidates, with Sanders expressing the most principled opposition, a front-page story in the New York Times of March 28 shed a new light on the subject. In an article largely aimed at supporters of Donald Trump and headlined, "No, cutting the trade deficit won't make America great again," the Times' Neil Irwin explained why the deficit is useful for Washington. Among its benefits, wrote Irwin, is that, quote, "it helps ensure that the United States can afford to finance wars, and it gives the government greater ability to fight recessions and panics. A country experiencing a banking panic will see money sent out of the country, causing its currency to fall and its interest rates to rise. All that limits a government's options for fixing the problem." In 2008, Irwin writes, when the United States experienced a near collapse of the banking system, the opposite happened. But it's not just economics, he notes, and quotes Jennifer Harris, a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and author of a coming book, War by Other Means, on the use of economic tools in foreign policy. According to Harris, quote, "a lot of the benefits of having the reserve currency are more on the foreign policy side than the economic." In this regard, quote, she says, "the centrality of the dollar to global finance gives the United States power on the global stage that no other country can match." Irwin goes on. He said, Irwin notes it has enforced sanctions on Iran, Russia, North Korea, and terrorist groups with the implicit threat of cutting off access to the dollar payment system for any bank in the world that does not cooperate with American foreign policy. Part of what makes the United States powerful is the great importance of the dollar to global finance. And part of the price the United States pays for that status is a stronger currency and higher trade deficits than would be the case otherwise. The debate over the trade deficit is about more than Mexico and China. Cars and bananas are winning and losing, concluded the Times' Neil Irwin. It's about what makes America great and which of the country's priorities should come first, end quote. That's a rare bit of honest analysis on the New York Times, but frankly, if Irwin is not being cynical, I find his criteria for what makes a country great deplorable. Also deplorable, yet another headline in the New York Times last Friday, similar to what we've seen before and will likely see again. On the bottom of the inside page, it reads, quote, "Civilians killed in U.S. airstrikes. Afghan officials say Americans deny account," end quote. This one killed 17 civilians, among them a local elder who was on his way to mediate a tribal land dispute. That elder, Haji Razruddin, was reportedly strongly anti-Taliban and traveled with four bodyguards for that reason, all of whom also died in the blast from a Hellfire missile. A second strike soon after killed two people who had come to collect their bodies, and still a third strike murdered three more civilians who climbed a small hill nearby to try and see what had happened and why the two men sent previously had not returned, according to the Times. The district governor said an investigating team had determined that the people killed were civilians. But what is the word of an Afghan official against that of a spokesman for the U.S. military? In this instance, Brigadier General Charles H. Cleveland. Said Cleveland, "We can confirm that the U.S. conducted two counterattacks in Paktika on Wednesday afternoon. There was no evidence to indicate that there were any civilian casualties at all." End quote. It's time like this to recall the words of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who on April 4, 1967, speaking in New York's Riverside Church, described the United States as, quote, "the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today," end quote. 49 years later, to our everlasting shame, it not only still retains that dubious title, but also, without question, another one. America is the greatest purveyor of state terror in the world today, and no other country comes close. Tomorrow night on CNN, former Secretary of State Clinton and Senator Bernie Sanders will square off again in debate before the critical New York State primary next Tuesday. Sanders has won 7 of the last 8 contests, but Clinton is heavily favored to win in New York, where a victory for Sanders is a must. He has also had to weather a constant stream of attacks and snide remarks leveled at him from the liberal media across the entire spectrum. Thus far, Sanders has been endorsed by 8 members of the House, none from California. One of them, Hawaii's Tulsi Gabbard, an Indian-American and Iraq War veteran, who until she decided to endorse Sanders, was seen as an up-and-coming new face of the Democratic Party. In order to give her endorsement, however, she not only had to ignore warnings from fellow Democrats, she had to resign from the prestigious position as vice chair of the Democratic National Committee, which has made it clear from the beginning that Clinton is the party's choice. On March 9th, following Sanders' upset victory in Michigan, Gabbard was questioned about her support for the Vermont senator by CBS's News' DeMarco Morgan. In case you hadn't heard it, I thought the exchange was worth listening to on the eve of tomorrow's debate.
First, let's get your thoughts off of Sanders' win last night there in Michigan.
Well, it was incredible to see how the people of Michigan really stood up and let their voices be heard. You know, a lot of folks were saying that that was a race in Michigan that Sanders just could not win. But I think it really shows the power of our democracy and the power of people's voices when they are moved by some of these issues that are so important to all of us to go out and take action. And so we're very pleased with the outcome of that race last night.
Congresswoman, you were a member of the DNC committee and you recently resigned and endorsed Sanders. Why now? And why did you leave?
You know, as vice chair of the DNC, all DNC officers are supposed to remain neutral in our Democratic primaries, obviously, including our presidential primary. And I just got to a point where, as a soldier, as a war veteran, I was so frustrated that the most important issue, in my view, the question of war and peace and what qualities we're looking for in our next commander-in-chief, were simply not being addressed. I felt that I could no longer stand on the sidelines, and I needed to get in and to speak out, not only for myself. You know, I saw the cost of war firsthand during my first deployment, which was to Iraq. I worked in a medical unit. But for all of my brothers and sisters and for the American people, to point out the differences between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton on this issue of war and peace, on which candidate I feel would take us down a path towards peace, as opposed to Hillary Clinton, who has shown through her record and her current positions that she will continue us to take us down this road of interventionist regime change wars that have cost us far too much.
But Congresswoman, there is a large delegate deficit in place. Clinton obviously has a massive lead when it comes to delegates. Sanders, it could possibly be impossible for him not to catch up, and you still chose to endorse him. Is that good for the party?
Well, because there are many, many states and many people across the country who have yet to cast their votes. And while I know many political pundits like to say that this is impossible, it's not over until it's over. And I have faith in our democracy. And Senator Sanders is promising to carry his message and to bring this choice and allow the American people to choose in this Democratic primary who they would like to see go forward and represent them in the general election.
What about any retaliation? The Clintons have had a well-oiled machine in Washington for years. Do you fear any retribution from the Clintons? And what's your relationship been like with it?
Well, you know, I was heavily warned by people who care about me to not endorse Senator Sanders because of that fear of retaliation. And look, that fear is something that exists in a lot of folks that I've heard from. There is far too much at stake here to stand on the sideline and let politics get in the way of what's real. And what's real is war and the cost of war. I've seen and felt that cost firsthand through my service and my deployments to the Middle East. And I cannot stand on the sidelines and do nothing when we have a clear choice that many people are not informed about. There are very stark differences between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. And I'm going to do everything I can to make sure that people know what those differences are so they can at least make an educated and informed decision.
Critics say Sanders is weak when it comes to foreign policy. Hillary Clinton clearly has experience since she was former Secretary of State. Could he or is he ready to become a commander-in-chief?
I'm glad you asked that question, DeMarco, because it's important for the American people, for us to make a distinction between experience and judgment. And I'll tell you, as a soldier, what I look for as I'm examining who should be our next commander-in-chief is someone who exercises good judgment, someone who has foresight, and someone who has this military mindset, which means you take a look at a specific course of military course of action, and you analyze it carefully to really look at what will the consequences of that course of action be? How will our enemies react to that? What will our reaction to that be? And go through this process so we know exactly how things are likely to play out before that action is taken. And I know through my conversations with Senator Sanders and through his record that he does have that good judgment to make sure that we are no longer spending our precious resources and lives in these interventionist regime change wars, and instead use those resources to nation build and invest in our communities right here at home.
And Congresswoman, one final question for you. In the event that Sanders is not the nominee, will you throw your support behind Hillary Clinton? And do you think his supporters will follow?
Well, DeMarco, we'll cross that bridge if and when we get there. I and a lot of others are going to do everything that we can to make sure that Senator Sanders is our Democratic nominee that we're going to take through the general election and beyond.
All right. You have spoken, Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard. Thank you so much.
And it was Tulsi Gabbard.
First, let's get your thoughts off of...
That was Tulsi Gabbard from the 2nd Congressional District speaking on CBS March 9th. Finally, there's an incident that took place in Israeli-occupied Hebron in late March that has led to an unprecedented verbal attack by Israelis, that is, Israeli Jews, against Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and the heads of the Israeli Defense Force, who are ordinarily viewed in the most heroic light. It was a cold-blooded assassination of a wounded Palestinian by an Israeli soldier in Hebron that was captured on video. Be assured, the eruption of anger was not because Israelis suddenly acknowledged the injustice of their decades of occupation of Palestinian land or the ethnic cleansing that preceded it. Far from it. On that March afternoon, two young Palestinian men tried to stab Israeli soldiers at a checkpoint in occupied Hebron, an act that is sanctioned by international law, but which is never mentioned when the occupiers are Israelis. After lightly wounding a soldier, one Palestinian was quickly shot and killed, and the other wounded, and as the video taken of the scene shows, he lay bleeding and unattended on the ground as Israeli soldiers stood around idly chattering. An Israeli blogger described the scene. Quote, "The Palestinian who'd been wounded, Abu al-Fatah al-Sharif, lay on the ground near a group of settlers and soldiers. One of the settlers said to the soldiers, quote, 'This a-hole here is still breathing.' An IDF soldier who was a medic in the unit and who treated the wounded soldier asked permission from his commanding officer to, quote, 'finish off the wounded Palestinian.' Apparently, the commander approved. The soldier walked to within 6 feet of the wounded Palestinian, cocked his rifle, and shot him. This practice is often called, quote, 'confirming the kill' in the IDF. The immediate excuse offered by the soldier for the execution was that the wounded Palestinian might have been carrying a bomb, but no one was buying it. An Israeli doctor, after watching the video, commented, quote, 'Maybe it's because I'm a doctor, but when I watched the video, I couldn't take my eyes off the Magen David Adam medical team.'" That's like the Israeli Red Cross. "At the scene, treating the wounded soldier, completely ignoring the man lying wounded on the street, evacuating a soldier in an ambulance, and then, boom, a murder. Such executions of Palestinians are not unusual. What was different is like what we have seen with police killings in the U.S. It was caught on video. Moreover, another video showed the killer walking over afterward to be congratulated with a handshake from Baruch Marzel, a Boston-born settler leader and disciple of the late racist Rabbi Meir Kahane and his Koch party. The group was outlawed by Israel in 1994 after Koch supporter, American-born doctor Baruch Goldstein, gunned down 29 Muslim worshippers as they were praying at the Cave of the Patriarchs, also in Hebron. I should mention that there is a monument to Goldstein in a nearby Jewish settlement of Efrat, and settlers in Israel consider Goldstein to be a hero. In the most recent instance, the government of Prime Minister Netanyahu and the head of the Israel Defense Forces were forced to respond and condemn the murder as being unacceptable practice for an army that claims to be the most moral on the planet. Some right-wing politicians and their supporters, however, reacted angrily to their response, forcing Netanyahu to backpedal at the start of the next cabinet meeting. Quote, "Any challenge to the morality of the IDF is outrageous and unacceptable," he said. "The soldiers of the IDF, our children, maintain high ethical values while courageously fighting against bloodthirsty murderers under difficult operational conditions. I am certain that in all cases, as in the current one, the inquiry takes into account all conditions. We must support the IDF chief of staff, the IDF, and our soldiers who safeguard our security." A poll taken by Israel's Channel 2 showed that 57% of Israeli Jews said there was no need to arrest a soldier or launch an investigation into the killing, while over 40% considered the soldier's action responsible. Only 5% considered the killing to be an act of murder, which is consistent with polls taken during Israel's periodic wars on Gaza, which showed them to have been supported by 94% of Israel's Jews. I have been unable to find any record of an Israeli soldier ever being sent to prison for murdering a Palestinian. This is Jeff Blankford. Thank you very much for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Week in Palestine.
طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح طفلة تمتطي
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the mainstream media. This is your host, John Roberts. This week we feature Allison Weir, founder and director of the organization If Americans Knew. This presentation was given in Natick, Massachusetts. Allison Weir is one of those curious people who, when confronted with what was happening in Israel-Palestine, and knowing very little, decided to go over there to see for herself. She was so disturbed and moved by what she saw and learned that she came back and founded her organization, the mission of which is to educate Americans concerning the conditions in Palestine. Allison Weir's talk is too long to broadcast in its entirety, and so is edited for this broadcast. What has been omitted is some of the description of her first trip. So the talk begins with her coming back from her trip and deciding to found the organization If Americans Knew.
And so when I came back from that first trip, I started an organization to give Americans the facts on this issue, all Americans, and I named it If Americans Knew. We especially focus on the media. I feel that in a democracy, in a republic, the most powerful institution is the news media. That is how we learn what we think we know about many issues, especially international issues. So we decided to do some studies on the media. My son is a scientist. I like the idea of choosing some a category that would be acknowledged as significant and that was quantifiable, as immune to subjective bias as possible. So we chose to look at how the media covered deaths among both populations. We especially, in one of our studies, focused on the first year of the uprising, because first impressions are so powerful. We then looked at a subcategory category that's especially troubling, the killing of children. I think that we're all deeply saddened when we hear that a child has been killed, regardless of their race, religion, ethnicity, or nationality. I think we're deeply saddened. Children are not supposed to be killed, but they are being killed. So we need to answer this very sad question. Using an Israeli source, we discovered that 28 Israeli children had tragically been killed by Palestinians, and 131 Palestinian children had tragically been killed by Israelis. How were these deaths covered? How many of them were covered by the primetime network news shows? Well, we found that they had reported on Israeli children's deaths at rates up to 13 and 14 times greater than they reported on Palestinian children's deaths. Some of you are probably noticing they're over 100%. We were counting every time there was a report on a child's death. So we knew there would at times perhaps be follow-up reports. We were astounded to find that the news coverage of Israeli deaths in general is usually over 100%. And for Palestinians, it's never even close. Then we, in our study of the New York Times, and all of this is on our website in greater detail, in our study of the New York Times, we decided to graph our data chronologically for that first year, just to see what that would look like. So we will show this next slide will be the curve of the New York Times reporting on Israeli children killed that first year, first 12 months. Then we'll see the actual death curve of Israeli children that first year, which is the light blue line. It's a little bit lower because the New York Times had not followed reports on Israeli children. But it's a very similar curve. Next, we'll see the New York Times reporting on Palestinian children that first year. It's the red line, a little bit lower, but right along the same curve, interestingly. Then we'll see the actual death curve of Palestinian children killed that first year. And this is it. Many people will tell me that they do feel well-informed on Israel-Palestine because they listen to NPR. Pro-Israel organizations have frequently attacked NPR as allegedly being pro-Palestinian in their coverage. They've caused financial damage to some NPR affiliates around the country, including, I think, here in Boston. So an organization called Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, FAIR, a well-regarded media watchdog group that does studies of media coverage on many issues, decided to look into NPR's coverage of Israel-Palestine. Their researcher, Seth Ackerman, did an excellent study, and he found that, yes, indeed, NPR is quite distorted on their coverage in this issue. But once again, it's actually in a pro-Israel direction. He gave his study a brilliant title. He called it The Illusion of Balance, because he found that NPR was carrying almost the exact same number of stories on Israeli children and on Palestinian children. It looked just the same. So to many people, that seemed like objective, balanced, neutral reporting. In reality, that wasn't balance. That was distortion. I would suggest that was manipulation. That meant they were reporting on almost all the deaths among one population and a small percentage of the deaths among another population. Throughout the past 15 years, every so often when there is Palestinian lethal violence against Israelis, we're frequently told that a calm has been shattered and that Israel responds. So we always hear that Palestinians have shattered a period of calm with their violence. There is a headline of that sort on the Los Angeles Times website in 2005. In late afternoon, early evening, I saw it there. many hours before the newspaper would actually be printed. So I called them up because I thought they would not want to print an inaccurate headline. And I told them that during what they were saying was a period of calm, that 170 Palestinian men, women, and children had been killed, and that during a period they were saying was calm, 379 had been injured. Their response to me was, we said relative calm. And they didn't change a single word in their story or in any of this easily verifiable information. There are so many omissions, I cannot come near giving all of them, but I'll give a few that I think are especially important. There is dissent in Israel. There are various sorts of groups, religious, secular, rabbis groups, women's groups, of all sorts that are very many military soldiers refusing to serve in occupation, etc. There is considerable dissent in Israel. It's a small percentage of the population, but it is a significant phenomenon, and yet almost no Americans know what's going on. Similarly, many people will say, if only the Palestinians would use nonviolence. They say that because the media almost never tell people that the Palestinians use nonviolence every week, literally. In fact, often there are one or two or three nonviolent demonstrations every single week in the West Bank and in Gaza. Often by farmers, often in small villages. And yet we're almost never told about them. And this is an extraordinary phenomenon. In a number of cases, people from around the world, of all ages, backgrounds, and ethnicities, are coming in and joining this nonviolent movement, including some Israelis. And it's an extremely courageous activity to engage in, because it is almost always, I think always, met with extreme violence by Israeli troops. Many people have been killed and injured taking part in these activities. Most of them are Palestinian. But some of them have been Americans and foreigners. Rachel Corey was 23 years old when she was killed. Tom Herndon was 21 years old when he was killed. Many others have been injured. Tristan Anderson is brain damaged and in a wheelchair. Brian Avery is having his face reconstructed, etc. But we almost never are told about that. Another omission of a very different sort occurred in 2003. This wasn't far away on the other side of the world. This was something that happened in the United States, in Washington, D.C., on Capitol Hill. There was a report by the Independent Commission on the Israeli attack on the USS Liberty on Capitol Hill. It was chaired by a retired four-star admiral who had been chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Also on that panel, on Capitol Hill, was a rear admiral. And not just any rear admiral, this man had been in charge of the whole legal department of the U.S. Navy. Also part of that commission was a Marine general. And not just any Marine general, this man was the highest ranking Congressional Medal of Honor recipient in the United States of America. They announced their findings that Israel had attacked a U.S. Navy ship, that they had tried to sink it, that they had killed 34 Americans and injured over 170 of them. They announced that rescue flights to these men had been recalled by order of the President of the United States. They announced that this had constituted an act of war by Israel against the United States. They also announced that this had been ordered covered up by the President of the United States. Statements of that magnitude, made by officials of that high rank on Capitol Hill, are newsworthy. And yet there was nothing about it in the Washington Post, on Fox News, USA Today. About the only place you could read about it was the Stars and Stripes newspaper, the military newspaper abroad. And in the Congressional Record, it's there in detail. Now let's look at the recent Israel-Gaza wars, as our media call them. Let's look at the one, the fatalities on both sides, and we'll look at the one in 2008-09 that was over Christmas vacation. Perhaps some people didn't notice it. It's a very busy, special time for many of us. So here is the war of 2008-09. Those are the deaths on both sides, inflicted by the other. As I'm sure you're aware, that's not what a war looks like. That's what a massacre looks like. And then let's look at the one that took place summer before last, 2014. Now, in that war, the media coverage, all the media coverage, started the sequence of events that led to that war with the abduction of three young Israelis in June, who were abducted and tragically murdered. That's where they begin the sequence that then, they say, led to the war of the summer of 2014. Well, let's care about all people. Both populations matter. All human beings matter. Let's look at the deaths among both populations from the beginning of 2014. And we see that in January, some Palestinians had been killed, including a child. But apparently that's not worth mentioning. Then let's look at the next month, and we see, oh, more Palestinians have been killed, but apparently not worth mentioning. Then we look at the next month, and still more Palestinians were killed, including another child. Then we look at April, and there was an Israeli soldier, and another Palestinian was killed. Then we look at the next month, May, and we see still more Palestinians were killed, including two children. But apparently, none of this is newsworthy or worthy of mention. Then we get to June and we see the three Israelis. And then the media pay attention, and that is supposedly where the violence began. And then we see the next month, and that's what it looked like. As I mentioned, the news coverage always focuses on the three Israelis who were kidnapped. Well, again, there was a great deal of news coverage on them. We learned their names, we were concerned for their, what had happened to them. Well, let's again care about all people and look at the situation for both populations. Were any Palestinians perhaps abducted also? And let's look just from the beginning of 2014 through June to see if any Palestinians were forcibly abducted and imprisoned. And yes, over 2,000 Palestinians. But we only heard about three Israelis. And then let's look at the aftermath. Usually when there's a hurricane or a tsunami or an earthquake, we then see the people afterwards trying to rebuild their lives, their difficulties. Our hearts go out to them. Many times people send them aid, sometimes go to help. Well, in this case, we had over 100,000 people in Gaza made homeless. Thousands of people injured in a place where most of the hospitals had been destroyed or damaged. In a region where they were already under a blockade by Israel, and already many medications were scarce or non-existent, just normal medications. Even some of the things you need in an operating room were very scarce, even before the war. And yet, this also is apparently not newsworthy and gets little notice. When I began to look into this issue back in 2001, early 2001, I wondered, well, where did this violence come from? How did it start? What is it all about? And I began to read. And one of the first things that I learned was that when I was born, there was no Israel. When I was born, there was Palestine. At that time, it was under the British Empire. So where did this violence come from, and where did Israel come from? Well, many people are led to believe by the media that this violence has been going on for thousands of years. They've just been killing each other. Well, actually, if you look at Palestine in the late 1800s, it was under the Ottoman Empire at that time, you discover that it was at peace. That it was in some ways what we would call a multicultural population. And there was about 80% Muslim, about 15% Christian, and a little under 5% Jewish, all living together in harmony, as they had done for centuries. So where did the conflict and the violence come from? To understand that, you don't look in the region. It did not originate in that region. It began with a political ideology and movement in Europe, and soon in the United States, called political Zionism. This was a movement to create a Jewish state in Palestine. For a while, they considered a Jewish state in Argentina or Uganda, one or two other places, but very quickly, political Zionism was defined as a movement to create a Jewish state in Palestine in the late 1800s. Even though that meant that that would be dispossessing 95% of the inhabitants. But as I said, I'm focusing on the U.S., and it was very active in the United States since the late 1800s. I had no idea this had been going on. What shocked me with my research and when I was writing my book is that Zionism, political Zionism, has profoundly impacted our nation negatively. It has profoundly impacted the Middle East tragically, and it has profoundly impacted the whole world dangerously, with instability of all sorts. And yet, most Americans have never heard about it. If we went to ask the average person, what do you think of Zionism? Zionists, how do you define it? Most people, I feel strongly, would say what I probably would have said about 16 years ago. I probably would have said something like, I think I've heard that word. What does it mean? We've all heard of socialism, capitalism, communism, and yet this is a significant ideology that we don't even know about, most of us. In 1910, there were already 20,000 Zionists in the United States. They included lawyers, professors, businessmen. It was already, in the words of one historian, becoming a movement to which congressmen listened in 1910, especially in the large cities, probably this one. In 1914, there was an especially significant development. World Zionism, which I had not even known existed before, World Zionism moved to the United States in 1914, and the leader of World Zionism became Louis Brandeis, a prominent Boston attorney. In 1916, Mr. Brandeis became a Supreme Court justice. He is an especially well-known and highly regarded Supreme Court justice. I think most of us, if we try to think about named Supreme Court justices from the past century, I don't think we could name very many. But I think many of us could name Louis Brandeis. And yet, I suspect that many of us don't know he was the head of World Zionism. What it turns out that the common practice when one is named to the Supreme Court is to resign from your affiliations, board memberships, etc., so that you'll be neutral. There won't be any conflict of interest if you resign those things. So Louis Brandeis resigned his leadership of World Zionism outwardly, but in reality, he continued to lead it. This is mentioned in a number of books. His loyal lieutenants would come into his Supreme Court chambers, report on what they were doing, and he would give them directives in his Supreme Court chambers to go and carry out. I was shocked to learn that, of course, is highly improper, which is probably one of the reasons that he kept it secret. But of course, you also sometimes it's more effective when you do things secretly. Well, then I learned something even more astounding. So I'll give you my source. If you do get my book, and I hope you do, you'll see that it's literally over half citation. So everything I'm saying, you can look at my source for. But I'll give you the citation for this next information because it is truly quite astonishing. What I was doing was looking for books on this issue that looked like they would be factual and reliable. I would read those books, and then I would look at the footnotes to see where specific information had come from, get the books from those footnotes quite often, read those books, look at those footnotes, and on and on. One of the books that I read was an especially mainstream book called Israel in the Mind of America, published by a very mainstream publisher. The author is a very establishment author named Peter Gross, who tilts towards Israel. He's definitely tilts more towards Israel than to the Palestinians. He was diplomatic correspondent for the New York Times, and then he was at Harvard for a number of years. He wrote several well-regarded nonfiction books. Well, in his book, he said that Louis Brandeis had been the leader of a secret Zionist society. that had operated in the United States. I was shocked to read such a thing. So, of course, I looked at the footnote to see where that information had come from, and I discovered it was from a scholarly journal, the American Jewish Historical Quarterly, an article published in 1975, The Parachute, a Secret Episode in American Zionist History. So then I looked into, well, who wrote that article? Is this a reliable author? I assume that their articles are peer-reviewed, but I still wondered, who wrote it? Is this someone that is seems to have the credentials to write on such a topic? Well, it turned out that it was an Israeli professor from a mainstream Israeli university, Dr. Sarah Schmidt. Her field of expertise is Zionism, especially American Zionism. She was the author. And in this book, she wrote that Zionism, that the Parachute, was an elitist secret society. It was the Hebrew word for Pharisees and separate. The members spread across the land. They worked to plant ideas and to influence people, especially at high levels of government. They recruited people of all sorts, especially Harvard students were recruited quite a bit because Brandeis had a number of connections to Harvard. And there was even an induction ceremony when someone joined the Parachute in which they swore that their devotion to Zionism would exceed their devotion to family, school, nation. And the Supreme Court Justice was a member of this. In fact, it appears that Felix Frankfurter probably also was. In 1915, a member of the Parachute, in fact a leader, suggested that the British might gain benefit from a declaration in support of a Jewish national homeland in Palestine. Those of you who have heard of the Balfour Declaration may be connecting this up. But for those of you who may not know that, as I would not have, may be wondering, what does this mean? Why would the British have anything to do with Palestine, with a declaration about a Jewish homeland in Palestine? Because, as I mentioned, in 1915, Palestine was still under the Ottoman Empire. Huge as the British Empire was, it did not include Palestine. So, what would they get out of this? Why would they want to do that? Well, let's remember what was going on in 1915. It was what they called at that time the Great War. This was a massive carnage and bloodshed. And the British were in danger of losing that war. In the first day of the Battle of the Somme, a battle that went on for months, British casualties were 60,000 men in one day of battle. So they were desperate for the U.S. to come in on their side. The Germans also wanted the U.S. to come in on the German side. But the American public, being that apparently bad thing, were what's called isolationists. They didn't want to go to join a foreign war to kill and be killed for something that had nothing to do with them, a war that most people feel was pointless. Woodrow Wilson was even elected to a second term of office with the slogan, "He kept us out of the war." But to the Zionists, especially the British Zionist named Chaim Weizmann, who later became president of Israel, Chaim Weizmann, who was in Britain, went to the British government in their desperation and claimed that the Zionists could influence the U.S. to come into the war on the side of Britain through their colleagues in the United States. They specifically mentioned Louis Brandeis, who was close to Woodrow Wilson. So they claimed that they could do that and that they would do that if the British government would then assure them that they would facilitate their Zionist project to colonize Palestine and to take it over for a Jewish state. This is how they got the Balfour Declaration. It's mentioned in a number of books. It was called the Gentlemen's Agreement, sort of a political goal. And from this agreement, the British did indeed issue a declaration called the Balfour Declaration. It's fairly mild. But it says that the British government would view with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people, as long as it did not prejudiced some of the rights of the non-Jewish communities in Palestine, which were 90% of Palestine. By the way, this declaration, which mild as it may sound, is considered quite significant because it sort of opened the door, cracked open the door to the British support for Zionism. The Balfour Declaration, by the way, was not written by Lord Balfour, who was the foreign mind minister of Britain. It was actually written by a secret Zionist, and his name is in my book. And the text of the Balfour Declaration, as it's called, went back and forth between the United States and Britain. And by the way, this was a letter to Lord Rothschild, who was another Zionist leader in Britain. After the war, there was the Paris Peace Conference, in which the winners divided up the spoils, and the British were put in charge of Palestine. They were given the mandate, it was called, over Palestine, and the Balfour language was then put into the mandate. So then immigration to Palestine greatly increased, and not surprisingly, sadly, but not surprisingly, it led to violent conflict. Indigenous populations do not want to be pushed out. So there was increasing violence. Innocent lives on both sides, then as now, were lost. Then as now, the large majority were the Palestinian Christians and Muslims. The Zionists formed two terror groups called the Irgun and the Stern Gang. The leaders of these groups later became Israeli prime ministers. In fact, one of them in the Nakba Baby, at one point bragged that they had. He was asked, how does it feel later? Journalists asked Menachem Begin, how does it feel to have introduced terrorism to the Middle East? And Begin responded, to the world. But I'm focusing on the American aspect, and it turns out there were a number of groups in the United States connected to those terror groups that were funneling them money and weaponry. One of the main ones was a man named Hillel Cook. In the United States, he went by the name Peter Bergson. He formed a number of groups with deceptive names. He was the Irgun operative in the United States. There's a whole book that tells about this. Another man who was connected with one of the terror gangs in what was called Palestine at that time for the Zionists was connected to the Stern Gang, and his name was Rabbi Baruch Korf. I believe he was from Boston. His father was a very prominent rabbi in Boston. So Baruch Korf was connected to the Stern Gang. In 1947, he was in Paris. Now, the British government periodically through the years as there was so much violent conflict in Palestine because of this Jewish colonization and Zionist plan to take it over, that they would periodically see there's all this violence. I wonder why. They would do a white paper and they'd say, oh, because the Zionists are taking over the land and the people don't like that. So then they would issue a white paper and they would sometimes restrict the immigration for a period of time. So then the Zionists would hate the British and kill the British. So in 1947, the British were restricting the immigration, the Zionist immigration to Palestine. So the Zionists hated the British, even though the British had just fought and defeated Adolf Hitler. So Korf and his group in Paris decided that they would get an airplane, they would make bombs, and they would fly over London and drop bombs on the British foreign ministry. They had the money, they had a plane, they were missing one thing, they did not know how to fly the plane. So then they then recruited a young American aviator who was in Paris, who had been an ace during World War II, to fly the plane for him. His name was Reginald Gilbert. Gilbert pretended to go along with the plot, but then he secretly went to the American embassy. They went to the Paris police and the Scotland Yard eventually, and the plot was foiled, and Korf was arrested and held for a while, but eventually released. He had very powerful friends in the United States, including, as I mentioned, his father. At his father's funeral, the mayor of Boston had come. So Korf got off and nothing happened. There were no consequences. But I was very curious about what it is about him, because he's really not mentioned in other books. In fact, none of this episode is in any other book that I'm aware of. So it turned out that Porth in later life became close friends with an American president named Richard Nixon. In fact, he is even reported to have influenced Nixon to a degree on some of his policies. And Nixon sort of fondly referred to Porth as his rabbi. Now, the precursor to today's AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, AIPAC is what is the most powerful foreign lobbying organization in the United States. And it is, according to Fortune magazine, the second most powerful lobbying organization in the United States of all of them. So AIPAC began, by the way, and it's just one entity. The Israel lobby, there are many, many other multi-million dollar entities. The annual budget of AIPAC is approximately $15 million. I was yesterday outside the AIPAC convention, where American political candidates always go to raise money and get endorsements. So the precursor to AIPAC came in 1939 with something called the American Zionist Emergency Council, AZEC. By 1943, AZEC had $500,000 at a time when a nickel bought a loaf of bread. Within not too many years, it had access to a far larger fund that eventually had the kind of money that in today's dollars is the equivalent of $1 billion with which to manipulate American society. They used it well. They targeted every sector of American society: congressmen, Christian clergy, editors, professors, both business and labor, Jewish war veterans specifically. Because during all this time I'm describing, pretty much all this time, most Jewish Americans were not Zionists. The large majority for many years had nothing to do with Zionism. Some were even actively anti-Zionist. So that sector of our population had to be propagandized just as much as the rest of us, and was done so even more intensively. There were hundreds of local committees around the country. They funded books and made them bestsellers. They were selling thousands of copies. Their petition and letter writing campaigns, etc. They also worked to manufacture Christian support. There were two Christian groups that were organized, and they were given money to push this in the Christian community to make, sort of convert Christians to becoming Zionists and support the Zionist project to take over Palestine. Now, during all this time, there was a great deal of diverse opposition to Zionism among different parts of our country. Some of the most distinguished and celebrated Christian clergy were opposed to Zionism for religious and moral reasons. American Christian leaders in the Middle East were opposed to Zionism. Some of them even traveled to the Paris Peace Talks to specifically advocate on behalf of Arabs, advocating for self-determination of the Arab peoples. That's what Woodrow Wilson was enunciating at the Paris Peace Talks. One of the most distinguished Tennessee scholars, Miller Burroughs, wrote a wonderful book called Palestine Is Our Business. In it, he talked about the American responsibility to uphold human rights for Palestinians. It's an excellent, very moving book. And yet, for writing that book, he was called anti-Semitic, even though he had a life history of interfaith relations and opposing all bigotry. Also opposed to Zionism was the American Council for Judaism. Rabbi Amor Berger and Alfred Lilienthal wrote excellent books opposing and exposing Zionism. Lilienthal, in particular, wrote a number of excellent books, and yet very few people know about those books. They're very worth reading. The governmental establishment opposed Zionism year after year, beginning with President Taft. The Secretary of State opposed it. Under Woodrow Wilson, he sent a commission to Palestine to investigate the feasibility of creating a Jewish state in Palestine. The Kincaid-Crane Commission came back and with a very powerful report, and said that that would be a great trespass on the rights of the people there. Zionism should be abandoned. But their report was buried and had little impact, partly through the help of Louis Ramos. Diplomats, the Pentagon, intelligence agencies gave report after report, memo after memo, advising against supporting Zionism, saying time after time that it would jeopardize American interests, that it would be bad for Americans, and in some cases they even said that it was against American principles. I won't go through all of these. They're in my book, but there are many, many, many statements and studies that they did, both the diplomats, CIA, etc. But Harry Truman, like all politicians, like his opponent, Thomas Dewey, was more interested in winning an election than in doing the right thing. And he said, "I'm sorry, gentlemen, but I have to answer to hundreds of thousands who are anxious for the success of Zionism. I do not have hundreds of thousands of Arabs among my constituents." Even though his Secretary of State, General George Marshall, the famous Marshall, had told Truman that he wouldn't even vote for him if he sacrificed American interests just for an election. Then in 1947, the British finally gave up. There was so much violence, their empire was pretty much coming to an end, and they turned the question of Palestine over to the United Nations to solve. The UN at that time could have affirmed their bedrock principle, their charter principle, the core principle of democracy, which is self-determination of peoples. The people that lived in Palestine could have voted their own government, created their own country. But instead of doing that, because of bribes and threats well documented, the General Assembly voted a partition recommendation in which 55% of Palestine would be given to Israel, to a Jewish state, and the Palestinians would be left with about 45%. Even after decades of immigration and trying to take over the land, the Jewish population was only 30%, and yet they were getting 55% under this plan. And the land ownership is interesting to look at, because many people are led to believe and have been told, well, they bought that land. Well, they tried to. You can dispossess people legally by buying up the land and getting rid of them that way. They tried to do that, but they failed. They increased Jewish ownership significantly. It was originally very urban and about 1%. So they got up to about, at most, 8%. Most historians said that the Jewish ownership at this time was approximately 5 or 6%. So a group that owned about 8% of the land was going to get 55%. This has no force of law, but this was the recommendation. Now, as we know, the more unjust a situation, quite likely the more unjust it is, the more violence that ensues. So rather than bringing peace or resolving the situation, it, I think, did the opposite. There was then the war that Israel calls its War of Independence, and the Palestinians call it al-Nakba, the catastrophe. It was a massive humanitarian catastrophe. At least 750,000 men, women, and children were very ruthlessly forced off their land. There were many, many massacres. Most Americans didn't know this was going on, but one American journalist tried to tell Americans about it. Her name was Dorothy Thompson. According to the Britannic Encyclopedia, Dorothy Thompson was one of the most famous journalists of the 20th century. I think they even named her the most important female journalist of the 20th century. She was truly amazing. She had a great, but I had never heard of her. Most of us had never heard of this most famous woman journalist. She had a radio program that was listened to by millions of Americans. She had a newspaper column that was in newspapers all across the United States. She was such a celebrity that there was a play loosely patterned on her life in which she was played by Katharine Hepburn, and a Broadway play in which she was played by Lauren Bacall. She was an amazing journalist. In the 1930s, she had been a foreign correspondent in Germany. She was one of the first journalists to raise the alarm about Hitler. And in fact, she was the first foreign correspondent to be ejected by Hitler. Because of that, she was very sympathetic to Zionism. But then after the war and after Israel was created, she went over to see this wonderful new Jewish state that had been created, and she discovered, of course, hundreds of thousands of Palestinian refugees. Living under extremely harsh conditions, many dying every day, very harsh conditions. And she began to speak about them and to write about them, and for doing that, for telling about these people, she lost her radio show, she lost her newspaper column, she lost her fame for talking about these people, and she was, as her biographer put it, she was erased from history. And now today, if I tried to write a magazine article from some of the information in my book, as would be, you know, a common thing to do, and have it published by a popular history magazine, maybe something like American History Magazine, it would not get published. Now, how do I know that? Because several years ago, we tried to place a paid advertisement in American History Magazine. Not for my book, for another book by a 91-year-old retired American congressman. By the way, as I'm sure you know, advertising is the lifeblood of the magazines. They're desperate for advertising. But we were told that they would not publish our paid advertisement. Their owner, Eric Weider, told us that he would not ever publish any paid advertisement from our organization, Council for the National Interest, because we were, as he said, anti-Israel. And in fact, he volunteered, they would not publish any advertising from us in any of the newspapers that they owned, which is virtually every popular history magazine in the United States, is owned by Weider Associates. Let's remember, Israel-Palestine is the core issue of the Middle East. It has been the core issue of the Middle East for almost 70 years now. Our invasion of Iraq was driven by Israel partisans on behalf of Israel neoconservatives in the Bush administration. This was written about openly in the Israeli media, unlike the American media. So we invaded Iraq, killed thousands of Iraqis, destroyed that country, and left it in shambles. So then the chaos and anarchy and tragedy, of course, spread across borders. And we have Syria in extreme turmoil, massive numbers of refugees fleeing, some of them not making it. And then we look at Iran. Some years ago, some Israel partisans working for Netanyahu, Douglas, very high-level Americans, such as Douglas Feith, who was Deputy Undersecretary of State of the defense in the Pentagon, Douglas Feith and some others, had written a position paper for Benjamin Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Israel. This was before he was Prime Minister. About the concerns Israel would have, sort of a position paper, about what they needed to be concerned about. And in that paper, they said there are three countries Israel needs to be concerned about because potentially, at some point in the future, they could be of danger to Israel. And those three countries were Iraq, Syria, and Iran. So then, for many years, we have been hearing about Iran and how dangerous it is to Americans, even though our intelligence agencies again and again have found that there's no evidence, no evidence whatsoever that Iran is developing a nuclear weapon, but it is supposedly a danger to us. And there was the same groups that pushed the invasion of Iraq are pushing us to invade Iran and similarly destroy another country. There was an advertisement in the New York Times several years ago, a full-page advertisement demonizing Iran, making it seem dangerous to us, I'm not giving a job in particular. And in the bottoms of that full-page ad, there were the icons and the names of the groups that had paid for that ad and put it in. And I put the names over on the left side so that you could read who it was that was pushing this demonization of Iran. This has been going on for year after year. It's gotten worse. We see the results in Belgium now. We see the increased extremism and violence. And this will grow worse, and is growing worse, unless we learn the facts, unless we share the facts with others, and unless we speak out. If we don't do that, it will get worse. If we do speak out, we can and will stop it.
You have been listening to a speech by Alison Weir, founder and director of the organization If Americans Knew.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002, and has been broadcast on community radio stations in Preston, Swindon and St Albans, and Bristol Community FM. We're back on BCFM, apparently, with a new schedule in the middle of April, Tuesday at noon. This week, The Big Short. Could it happen again? If you saw the film over Christmas, you know what I mean. The Big Short was all about the mistakes in the run-up to 2008. But Britain's national debt is now at £1.5 trillion and climbing fast. Doesn't look like any prospects are of stopping the rise in the deficit all the time. And are we due, then, another 1929-style crash? Not a bailout, a crash this time. An exclusive interview with one of the world's smartest economists, Anastasia Nesvatilova. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk, and I'll give our contact details at the end of the show.
My name is Anastasia Nesvatilova. I'm Professor of International Political Economy at City University London. I also direct City Political Economy Research Centre. This is our think tank or a research platform where we bring together economic and political concerns, research into very recent or current developments, and we open it up to public and policy scrutiny. I work on finance. This is my specific area of research, and I have published various works, including books, on the topic of financial crises, financial fragility, and regulation.
Now, most people are aware that there was a big crisis and bailout in 2008. I wonder whether you think we've learnt the lessons and that we're now away from the brink.
Good question. It's also vague enough to accommodate a variety of concepts what a lesson would mean. Some people did. There are some lessons there are some implications for post-crisis policy that would be quite unimaginable in early 2007. For instance, there is a much greater cooperation, there is much more data, there is much more work, there is much more, in a way, openness at the regulatory level. So the international regulatory bodies that were, you know, important but technocratic institutions, some of them were blinded by some ideology, but a lot of them were in line with the market. They were broadly in parallel to the market developments. They were issuing programs and policies that would emphasize how important it is to deepen your financial system or liberalize your banks or open up your economy for further financial competition and innovation. This is what they were usually publishing. So now when you look at the IMF, when you look at the OECD, when you look at Bank for International Settlements, even the Financial Stability Board, which was at that time Financial Stability Forum, and to be honest, quite useless at its task in 2006, they all have become very much more empowered. They have more people, they have more data. They broadly now have much more understanding of what's going on in the markets and what went wrong back then. Some of the central banks are closer in touch with the banking system developments and with the financial markets, and I can say they're more on the ball. In fact, central banks have pretty much saved the world economy back in 2008. It was due to them, not to anybody else, that we have averted the full scenario of the 1930s. But, so this is the, if you want, the more positive view on the big transformation or a transformation since 2007. The lessons within the industry, I'm cautious to say that some have learned them, and that includes some big banks that decided to do something about their affairs, to clean up their books, to try to manage their risk better, to try to account for the risks they take better, to try to not to replicate the behavior of 2007. And then some didn't do it all. Some either had the privilege, in Deutsche Bank, for example. They escaped relatively unscathed in 2007, and that gave them some leeway to sort of not do a big reform, internal reform in the bank in the following years. And they are paying a high price now. Same for some of the European banks, same for UBS. And of course, it's all is very much overshadowed by parallel scandals that we are now so familiar with, the LIBOR, foreign exchange, and others, mis-selling of loans. Politicians, this is another segment. I think it's the weakest link in all this map. When compared to regulators or the banks themselves, I'm not sure politicians have learned anything. They have learned that it's not very nice to be in power when a big financial crisis happens, because it gets blamed on you. But then it's just the legacy and the complication between political, economic, and financial factors that have facilitated the disaster in 2007 is so complex that it's difficult to fit it into such a short-term political cycle. You see, all politicians, they operate on a 4-5 year cycle of needing to be re-elected, and it's nowhere close enough to what is needed to understand, regulate, reform, unpack the processes that go inside finance.
Because, I mean, you seem to be saying in some ways more positive than negative things.
I'm saying, well, look, I'm an academic, so it's my job to be, you know, fairly analytical. And I do see some change in the way finance is now understood. And this change, ironically, it hasn't been led by academics themselves. So, for example, the people who you and I, the public, would assume to know about banks, the financial markets, the economy, the economists. They're still very much where they were in the 1970s and the 1980s and in 2005. They still construct their models, they assume rationality, and they maybe they now apply these models to banks, but they are very abstract and they were not very helpful in 2007, and they haven't learned the lesson that economics actually needs to be a science of reality, or a science reflecting the reality. They're still publishing, you know, very abstract, very theoretical, quantitative papers. But at the same time, I do see more than the rhetorical change in the way regulators, researchers working for the regulators understand finance. And that's, I cannot not admit it. I also know that inside the banking system, there are, you know, big and small, there are more complex and less complex institutions. And there has been some understanding that things went wrong in 2007. But and again, I have to say it, finance is not only about banks. In the UK, the banking system controls, I think, if I'm not mistaken, just over £7 billion. And the non-banking share of the financial system, the hedge funds, asset management industry, pension funds, control over £4.2 billion sterling. At the same time, the wealth management sector, according to the Bank of England data, globally controls £15 trillion of assets. This is wealth. This is wealth being managed directly and indirectly by very few people around the city. And I just checked, this industry employs only 31,000 as of 2014 in the UK. So it shows how fragmented and concentrated, but also very complex finances. And we would be making a mistake saying that it's only about banks or it's only about hedge funds. It's actually about many things together. And the shadow banking system has grown since 2007 from about $60 trillion US dollars globally, 225 as of last count by the Financial Stability Board.
We've recently had questions over Deutsche Bank. I mean, that's just literally in the last couple of months. And one does wonder if we're still in the situation where there are banks out there that are too big to fail, and that if things start to go wrong, there will be more demands for public money and more massive increases in national debt around Europe to keep bailing these banks out. What happened at Deutsche Bank?
Well, Deutsche Bank is the story that I tried to tell just a minute earlier. It's one of the big banks, global banks, that wasn't as hurt as others in 2007, partly because they played the mortgage game better or the derivatives game better. But that also didn't push them to reform. In some ways, they were the last to close the fixed income department. So this is the department that usually deals with complex structures, potentially with toxic exposure. My sources tell me that there are internal culture problems between top management and medium management, where the sense of illusion or delusion that led top management to current situation. So the sluggishness to reform, inability to act, inability to recognize the moment where they had to move out of certain things and reform their operations. So this is all compounded and is a legacy of that time. So Deutsche Bank's problems today is a legacy of that time. But you're absolutely right, Deutsche Bank is too big to fail. It will be, even if it comes to the very brink, which according to some market sources it already had done, it will of course be saved by the German government. Maybe the taxpayers will be pulled into the operation, partly because it's very easy now to issue government debt, especially if you're Germany, because everybody wants your government debt as a financial security in the markets. So it's not only necessary for a bank resolution, but also convenient to issue public debt when you're a big state like Germany. UK or US, there are three governments that are safe havens for the financial markets, and for each one of them it's very easy and cheap to raise public debt now in the markets. Everybody wants that particular collateral.
Another side of all this is the power relations, really, between the bankers, between the directors of the bank, the shareholders of the banks, and politicians that we elect, because we'd like to think that those politicians can put things in order to make sure that, you know, that there's not a, almost a great sucking sound as all people's savings disappear, you know, as has happened in many countries such as Argentina. So I'd like to ask you about that. Is it I've heard some commentators talking about the way that the banks almost give ultimatums to politicians, almost like having a suicide bomber in the room that says, you either you do this or we blow up. And also, they're in a very powerful situation, aren't they, because of the governments are now massively indebted. Whatever George Osborne has been trying to do, he's actually almost doubled the national debt. We're now at £1.5 trillion national debt in Britain. And it doesn't look as if that's ever going to be paid off because of the impossibility, it seems, of turning the economy around. So just could you just explain to us, what is the real power relationship between the banks and the Chancellor and our elected politicians?
Good question. Half of Tory party's donors are hedge funds. Okay, so this is, again, an illustration that there is a powerful financial lobby, especially in the UK, around the City of London, and that includes financiers and lawyers who work for them and the big accounting firms. But not all of them are bankers. So, for example, there are big American firms, big American banks working in the city, and some of them would have very progressive views on how to reform the UK banking system or what is needed to be done, for example, on capital or leverage. And they are recognized problems at the moment. They're still, these are issues that are not resolved. There are also problems with accountability. But at the same time, yes, there is a view, and which I think I share, that overall, once you keep your banking system private and once you keep your banks as publicly owned companies, once they're too big to fail, they're systemically important institutions, they have enormous power to sabotage. And in this particular case, they are sabotaging what they are meant for in a democratic capitalist setting, if you want. It's not a very scientific phrase, but let's call it this for the sake of discussion. And that mission in an accountable capitalist system that works for the benefit of a society in a democracy is to provide the utility of banking service, payment system, clearing, and some investment for the public, not professional, but investment. But these operations are not very profitable for the big banks, especially when they're private. They're making money. They are over-leveraged and they are liaising with different clients. And structurally, they are the ones who are first in charge of our money. At the same time, they are the only institutions that create money in our economy, and they also are distributing the money to the economy by creating new credit. So overall, structurally, for any politicians, it's a lose-lose game. You cannot do anything. You have a nominally independent central bank you don't really control. You have a treasury, which is usually behind the problem. And yes, you have a fantastically powerful financial lobby with structurally important banks that are strategic entities in your economy. And yes, they do threaten that they will leave. Usually they don't, because the mobility of capital is being misused as a term. But at the same time, I have to say that the politicians, especially in the UK, did have a moment where they could do something about the banks, and they largely missed it. For example, they had several banks nationalized or semi-nationalized, and they didn't do anything to reform the overall structure, function, or indeed the morale of the banking system.
So in a way, it's the politicians' own fault. Anyway, we're coming along to referendum about the European Union. A lot of people looking at the Eurozone, particularly the financial connections and the Troika, the European Central Bank, and saying, well, actually, this is not working for Europe, particularly Italy, Greece, and Spain, etc. And I just wonder what you make of if, I mean, obviously things are just going to carry on as they are if there is a vote to stay in the European Union. But, I mean, if Britain votes for Brexit, what's the implications financially for the City of London and for the country as a whole?
I would quote a lot of people, but in this particular case, I would quote Mike Carney, the governor of the Bank of England, prepare for massive liquidity needs for bank bailouts. They will be exposed, they will have to cut risks, and their balance sheet will be devalued because Britain as a whole and British entities will be worth less once Britain is out. So this will be a massive financial crisis.
I mean, we're talking about literally the day after a Brexit vote?
Well, I'm not really a Cassandra. Gideon Rachman published a very funny article yesterday in FT that I enjoyed reading, what happens the day on the 24th after Britain votes out. It can happen within a relatively short time. Usually banking, a creeping and a systemic bank crisis, it doesn't happen in a day. It takes time to accumulate and evolve. But in this particular case, I don't think we will have many months to wait.
Didn't we really sign up to an international banking system in Britain when in 1980, when we just got rid of exchange controls? Isn't that kind of the beginning of an almost inevitable welding together of Britain with other European economies and other world economies?
Well, yes, Britain is the global hub for the world financial system. The City of London works as a huge offshore operation for everybody. It's a center for foreign exchange, it's a center for insurance and reinsurance, it's a center for global wealth management industry. So it's very tied in not only to Europe, but to the whole world. And therefore, it's so integral to the whole European and global architecture that breaking this link would disrupt a lot of, if you want, going concerns. Okay, so Britain as an economy is a going concern within Europe. It does have its problems, and Eurozone has its own problems. But as a whole, it works as a going concern. And once you break this important part, Britain, that going concern needs to be reevaluated. And this re-evaluation will make, in my view, Britain much less valuable and also much more isolated, and it's unclear for what. So I'm ardently pro-European and I'm ardently pro-EU vote, pro-stay-in vote. What is it formally called? Remain.
That's right, yeah. But a lot of people point to Europe, and maybe not the EU, but things like the Bank for International Settlements as being part of the problem. This is the central banker's central bank, that they really have completely failed on proper banking regulation, which has led to the problems we had in 2008. And also that the BIS is basically a kind of self-regulation system for banks. There's no real proper democratic accountability and oversight. And just to pile more problems on, I've just read a book recently by Adam Libor called The Tower of Basel, which mm-hmm. details the way that the Bank for International Settlements was intimately involved in providing foreign exchange for the Nazis in the Second World War and actually financed large parts of Hitler's rise to power. So is it really time for a proper look at banking regulation internationally and the BIS specifically?
Perhaps. Again, to my earlier point, it's the BIS that has been probably along with the IMF, the champion of some sort of self-reflection and reform. Before 2007, and I think that book you mentioned was published before that or around that time, it was one of the most secretive institutions. You would never be able to get an interview there as a researcher. It was very difficult, and there was practically no literature published in terms of good academic research. And suddenly, part of the crisis impact was that they had to open up. And as a result, we have more communication, we have more data, and also much more cutting-edge and critical research coming from the chief economists and economics department and the research department. And they're the ones arguing and demonstrating that, look, we have the big dichotomy between the so-called financial cycle. Okay, a financial cycle is basically an economic and credit-driven development, or a set of developments that is longer, that is driven by the elasticity of the financial system, and nobody knows how elastic it has become. Nobody knows when this financial cycle ends. It just seems longer than we ever thought. It's longer than the traditional business cycle, and mostly it's longer than the traditional political cycle in democracies. And they are saying that there are tangible political risks to not resolving the financial mess that we're now in, to not having enough tools to deal with the next turmoil when it comes. And yes, they were... Look, Basel has always been a compromise. Basel I, Basel II, and especially Basel III. There is a lot of critique of Basel III regulations. I don't want to defend them. They're pretty much toothless on capital. They have made great progress on liquidity provisions, and they made very little progress on accountability. And in fact, they can say it's not our job to do accountability. It's national jurisdictions. But Basel III has been broadly on the ball. It does tackle some of the big issues that led up to that contributed to the problems in the latest credit boom in between 2002-2007. Without the crisis, we would never have got Basel III. And as I'm saying, although there are problems still to be resolved, in terms of greater focus on liquidity, at least, in terms of some attempt to understand what systemic risk can be in the system, it's pretty much as good as we can get at the moment in terms of considering all politics, lobbyism, compromises, lack of democratic accountability, lack of people's involvement. But I actually have much more time for the Bank for International Settlements than you seem to have.
Well, I'm sort of pointing the finger at them in a way as creating the whole situation through self-regulation that didn't really work, that created the whole 2008 situation in the first place. But look, you mentioned there, you said crisis, the next crisis when it comes. A lot of commentators are saying that there simply isn't the money in the system to bail out the banks a second time. So could we see a more 1929-like catastrophic crash in the future?
Difficult to say. It's very likely that a crisis will come, possibly in the next 3 to 5 years. Whether it will involve a big bank or another non-bank financial entity or a set of financial entities, like, for instance, a pension fund or a big broker and somebody else with that particular broker. We don't know. I actually think that there are a lot of unknown risks in the shadow banking system, and resolving a bank crisis would not be the biggest headache of that particular crisis. And that's sort of the danger. The danger is that we don't know. We kind of know broadly what to do in a banking crisis. We can nationalize, we can restructure, we can sell off bad loans, we can, again, issue public debt if necessary. It's cheap enough. But we don't know what to do with a non-bank, shadow bank type of connection. And we don't know how risk spreads there, where it accumulates, how it spreads, who's exposed, how international it can be, and what are the actual costs. And that, I think, is the danger. And yes, for that, because it was never on the public provision map, the shadow banking system, it's never supposed to be resolved by a taxpayer injection or a central bank resolution. Yeah, the potential risks are quite high, and costs. And in principle, shadow banking is a kind of privately driven system of credit intermediation. We all are linked to it, but it's supposed to be separate from the regulated banking system. It's not, but it's this is what they consider. But there is a big question. So if one of our strategically important financial entities, insurance company or a pension fund or something connected to a big investment fund that has public exposure, what if they fail through a shadow banking system? What would a government do? And last time when the UK government faced such a dilemma with Northern Rock, I think they left it almost unresolved until the last minute. Maybe it's still unresolved now. It was the exposure of Northern Rock through Granite, through a Jersey-based offshore trust. So effectively, because they were very integrated together, the two entities cost the UK taxpayer twice, not only $50 billion that the UK government granted as a bailout, but also all the obligations that Granite still had outstanding at the time of a bailout, and they also equaled $50 billion. So this problem can now be multiplied several times over in the shadow banking system.
One of the problems is, potentially anyway, and I wonder what you make of this, is that people have raised is that bailout money that was given to banks has been used for further lobbying to consolidate their power.
Partly. You know what they did with so-called tax, not so-called, they were called tax arbitrage departments or desks in the banks before 2007. They now were renamed as capital structuring desks or capital market structure desks. They do exactly the same, but they were renamed. A lot of bankers are complaining that their job has become much more boring. You see, the volatility in the markets, because interest rates are low, it's not a very fertile environment for innovation. So those who want to really apply their brains, their mathematical brains, they're bored. But yes, nothing has changed in the ethos, morale, or behavior of banks. I don't expect it as a result of the crisis. Bankers are still bankers. This is what they were.
The tax justice campaigner, and I think he's an accountant too, Richard Murphy,
he said that
the electronic infrastructure of banking, things like the cash points and the various methods which are used to move money around the country, around the world, I suppose, Richard has said that it's important that this is in public hands, so that if banks fail, that it doesn't mean that the cash points fail all at the same time. I wonder if you think that's important.
Very much. This is what I call utility banking. This is the utility, the public provision of banking services to the public. This is exactly our daily operation, our daily life depends on those ATM machines and clearing mechanisms working. If they fail, there is a tangible risk that a train would not go on time, that a plane would not land or would take off, that you would not be able to extract your cash from an ATM machine. And that is a political risk. So, yes, it's important to have public control. What form it can take, it's clearly debatable. But I do believe that a state does have to play a bigger role in the banking and financial system than it does now.
But you see, the banks aren't going to let go of that infrastructure without a fight, are they?
Possibly, but yes, maybe. There will be a compromise. And it's important for politicians not to be ill-informed, okay? To have a conversation with the banking and financial sector, you need to be respected. So very blunt solutions would not work. But a public agency set up for a specific purpose, or even an idea of a public bank, a publicly owned bank as a contender, if it's a competition, then why not? Anyway, they have survived on subsidies from the state, according to Andy Haldane, for a long while now. They are private institutions, but they had been having a very good ride with an implicit state subsidy, and he estimates that particular state subsidy was around £70 billion before the crisis.
You used an interesting word there, utility. Now, I think of utilities like electricity, water, that sort of thing. And I think most of us would like our utilities provided roughly at cost in order to let us get along, you know, so that we're not paying over the odds for these things. And it's been one of the problems of privatisation that people are paying actually a lot more, for example, for energy than if it was provided at cost. So is there, by using the word utility, aren't you in a way saying that perhaps it's better that the whole of banking is just run like that by the government, by having one state bank that just simply provides this as a facility without taking a profit?
It depends what that bank does. You see, if it becomes a state-owned bank that does a variety of services, including commercial banking and investment banking and trading, then I think it it will not go ahead on the basis that it will be an unfair competition to privately owned similar structures, similarly structured institutions. But if it's a public bank that provides very basic services and it's the deposits are guaranteed in line with the existing law, then at the moment I don't see why not, apart from political pressure. Maybe some objection will come to me once we finish this conversation or later on, but I don't see why such a body cannot, for example, issue mortgages or provide checking accounts or even some sort of savings accounts to the public.
I wonder if you could just point us to one of your books or something that you think would be a good way for people who are aware that there are problems with the financial sector, that there's a lot of it is smoke and mirrors, as a way of kind of cutting through some of the jargon to get to the meat of how our financial system really works.
I didn't plan as a self-promotion, but I think the closest that I come to that is in my 2010 book. It's called Financial Alchemy in Crisis, The Great Liquidity Illusion. It's a very short book, a paperback. It was written in a very friendly language to do what you just asked, to dispel the jargon and the myth and this layer of obstruction about finance. So I try to be as clear as possible. And the message of the book, it's really about liquidity, how we come to think about wealth and money and liquidity in a particular way, and why this way led us to 2007, 2009. This is why I call liquidity illusion. And in very shortly, it's about the big transition from the 1930s to today. You see, we are now used to think of liquidity as something that is very fundamental to how markets work. Liquidity is impossible without a market being there. If we want to get a liquidity, if we want to sell something, we need to rely on the market. Be it a financial market, a real estate market, or any other type of market, we need to rely on the mechanism of exchange, pricing, discovery, and realization. But it wasn't like this all the time. Very long time ago now, back in the 1930s, again, when academics and intellectuals were very concerned with what was happening to American capitalism, primarily American, globally, of course, but the literature we have is mostly focused on the U.S., and they kept asking why, what is it about liquidity as a very important political or economic category? Is it about the asset or is it about the market? And a lot of them concluded that it's really about the asset. It's about something intrinsic to whatever it is that you're dealing with, be it a paper, be it a commercial title or a house. But they recognize that there is such thing as a natural or real liquidity embedded in a particular type of asset. And it can be high, it can be low, but it doesn't always depend on the market. It's not only given by the market. And what happened to us with the whole advance of markets, liberalization, and a particular market-led ideology from about 1970s onwards is that this recognition that an asset can have something intrinsic to it, can have a value and liquidity fundamentally inside it, has been lost. So the paradigm of markets deliver liquidity has become so paramount that Basel II, which you already mentioned critically, indeed has completely abstracted away from the idea of liquidity. It assumed that liquidity would always be there. There was nothing in Basel II about liquidity provisions. It was focused on solvency of banks, but not on the liquidity of their portfolios. And this is exactly what brought the system down. Progressive illiquidity, as I call it. So this is one of the publications that can shed some light on the history and contemporary dynamics of that.
Because I think for some of us, we look around and we see, well, actually more and more people seem to be investing in property and even just leaving that property empty so that they can sell it at the drop of a hat. And that's one of the major problems we've got in Britain now, is that quite a lot of money seems to be going into things like building, well, whether it's homes or actually, sort of industrial land or property that isn't actually being used. It seems like something's gone completely wrong with the system.
They're being used as assets to store value, to store and gain value, partly because there are no alternatives. The wages haven't been growing up. The yields on financial instruments are so low. So savings and credit are going into assets. They call it asset, capital market, or asset inflation.
And I suppose that might be because at least you know that you've got something at the end of the day. It can't completely crash the value of a skyscraper or a piece of land.
Correct. And numerous bubbles around the world have proven exactly that, that although there can be a crash and although those real estate prices can go down, something tangible and real is left behind. Roads, skyscrapers, hotels, office blocks, houses, yes. Also, it has to be said that, of course, with the whole pension crisis and pension reform provision, this is the only way for a lot of families to have any tangible savings for themselves or for their children. They cannot rely on the pension portfolio that they signed up to because they may not be delivering.
Okay, Anastasia, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
That's all for this week. Dialects Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast and has been broadcast on community radio stations in Bristol, Swindon, Preston and St Albans. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guest on the show, that was one of the world's smartest economists, Anastasia Nesvatilova, and also to Rick Margetts, our studio engineer. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Anyone can contribute. Just contact us through the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, who are just off to Jamaica Street. Call them on 0117 909 6897 or visit them on the web at prsc.org.uk. So that was Dialects. And I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Bye for now.
Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. I am Malihe Razazan. Khalil Bendit is away this week. Last week, a massive document leak known as the Panama Papers made headlines around the world.
As soon as we released the first article, the website is getting really slow and we have trouble accessing it again. And so an attack is being launched. And so the hacker went into the website. They changed the name of the person supposedly involved, and they replaced the name by the name of the president who was elected just after the revolution.
We'll talk with Sana Spawi, a Tunisian investigative journalist and editor of the independent news website Inkifada, about their collaboration on the Panama Papers, the largest journalistic leak in history that reveal how the political and powerful elites use secret offshore companies to hide their money and cover up their shady dealings. Later in the program, Womino contributor Josh Wilner will tell us about the Black Solidarity Statement with Palestine. One of the authors, Khoury Peterson-Smith, will be speaking this evening at UC Berkeley as part of the Black Palestine Solidarity Tour. All this coming up on this week's Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. Stay with us. On Sunday, April 3rd, in a coordinated effort, the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists and its media partners began releasing explosive news stories about offshore companies. The stories, which are packaged as the Panama Papers, are the result of the largest journalistic collaboration in history. The Washington-based International Consortium of Investigative Journalists enlisted 400 reporters from 100 media organizations in more than 80 countries to sift through millions of documents that reveal how the rich, the famous, and the infamous used Mossack Fonseca, a Panama-based law firm, to hide their money, avoid paying taxes, and cover up their shady deals. Their revelations are based on 11.5 million pages of documents that an anonymous source leaked to German newspaper Süddeutsche Zeitung. Among the 100 media organizations involved in this undertaking, six are from the Middle East and North Africa. I spoke with Sana Spaoui, a Tunisian journalist and chief editor of the French edition of Intifada, an independent investigative and reporting news site that covers the issues affecting the people in Tunisia. Intifada is one of 100 media organizations that collaborated with the team of journalists who spent 1 year looking into the leaked documents.
Intifada is a slow journalism website. When we launched it in June 2014, we wanted to change the way the media field was going in Tunisia. We love to do reports. We love to do investigation, to do data journalism. And the idea was to take the time to look somewhere else, not where everyone is focusing, not where all the journalists are focusing, but try look in a different way at what's happening in Tunisia and speak about it in a different way too. We do a lot of work around aesthetic and how the reader is going to be immersed in the article. So it's something which is completely different from what is done in Tunisia. It's something who is not running after the buzz, not running after the news. It's really about taking the time to think and to offer something, a different product, something with a lot of analyze inside, and something which is kind of a picture, doing documentation about what's happening in Tunisia now. It was really difficult to get a clue about what was happening under Ben Ali regime. Why we want to make sure that people in 5 years, 10 years, I don't know how long, they can still know what was happening in Tunisia during that time of the transition.
You mentioned data journalism. Can you talk about what it is?
It's grabbing data, no matter which kind of data it is, and trying to make it readable for the readers. I'm going to take a simple example. In Tunisia, we had strike in education system. The teacher wanted to have a better wage. And in front of them, the authorities were saying that strike has high costs and that because teachers are going on strike, we're losing money. And we wanted to look at the education system in another way. We wanted to look at how is the education system going in Tunisia and how we can reform it, because it needs to be reformed. So what we've done is that we grabbed all the data that we could find around education in Tunisia. How many schools in every area of Tunisia? How many students, university in every area of Tunisia? How many teachers for how many kids? How many classrooms for how many kids? How many pupils and students in the private sector, public sector. If you put all that data together, you have a headache because it's just Excel sheet of numbers and figures, and it's not readable. And what we've done, like a lot of journalists around the world do, is that we take those data, we treat them, and we present them in another way. So it was about doing graphics, doing maps to make the reader understand that in this area, poor area of Tunisia, there is not enough classroom or not enough teacher, and there are a high number of students. And in other parts of Tunisia, you have a lot of public school, and therefore you make sure that kids can have access to education, while in some other area, you don't have enough university, for example. Mm-hmm. And therefore, young students and young kids are dropping out of school because they don't have access to education and learning. So for us, that's a big example of what data journalism can do. It's about taking figures, numbers, data, who are supposed to be public, and make them available for the citizen to understand sometimes really big political issues that really matters, and we should look at it, which means that we've done it for the education system, but you can do it for the budget system. For example, in any country, and there are a lot of journalists around the world doing that, you can say, okay, here is the budget that we put on the army, and here is the budget that we're putting in the health system. Which kind of society do we want to live in? Therefore, you can try to read those data, make them understandable for the reader, and give him the clues to be aware citizen who will know what's going on in the political debate, on the public debate, and who will have all the weapons to make sure that he can use his citizenship to do something, can use his rights to try to build the world where he wants to live.
You rely heavily on official figures and statistics. How reliable are these numbers that are produced by various government entities? For example, the Department of Education in Tunisia.
Yeah, that's the main problem. It's how much you can rely on public data. In Tunisia, for a long time, we didn't have the public data, or they were fake ones that will mislead the reader. In Tunisia, before the revolution, the authorities were saying that 90% of the population knows how to read. And then we had the election, the first election after the revolution, where we end up with a third of the voters not able to sign because they don't know how to read. So if you think that a third of the voters don't know how to read and write, it means that not 90% of the population is educated. And it's really difficult to rely on public data in Tunisia at the moment. But it's getting better and better, and I think it's really important also to have independent entities who are working on collecting data and working on doing a watchdog. There are plenty of areas in Tunisia where we rely, unfortunately, on data produced by international organizations. If I want to know how is the water in Tunisia, how much water we still have, I have to rely on figures that were produced by the World Bank, for example, because I'm not sure about what the Tunisian authorities are saying. So it's difficult. That's a point really important that we have to be honest about, and we have to let the reader know. So I'm going back to the education data publication that we've done. The journalists came at some point and faced the fact that from one year to another year, the numbers of students graduating were changing, which means that in the report of 2012, we will read that in 2011, maybe 50% of the students graduated. But then when you take the report of 2013, for the same year, 2011, you'll see that like 55% of the students graduated. So we had, again, to go back to the authorities and say, okay, there's something wrong in your figure. Can you please help us to understand? Which is also a watchdog work, because at the end, we're making them facing the fact that there's something wrong there. So in Tunisia, it's a work that begins from scratch, and it's quite interesting for us.
And also, do you ever collaborate with investigative journalists inside Tunisia? And how much investigative journalism is really happening in Tunisia after the revolution?
Your question is really interesting because it's going to lead after to an impact of the Panama Papers. Mm-hmm. What I mean is that it was really difficult for people to do journalism to begin with and investigative journalism before the revolution. And therefore, like for the data, we are kind of beginning from the scratch around investigative journalism in Tunisia. And it's difficult to find people who can do it. It's difficult to have newsroom who allows journalists to work on this kind of issue and take the time to do so.
I'm speaking with Sana Spawi. She's a journalist and chief editor of the French edition of Inkefada, an independent investigation and reporting news site that covers issues affecting people in Tunisia. Sana covers social and economic justice issues, migration, and media. Inkefada is one of more than 100 media organizations from more than 80 countries that poured over 11.5 million files that reveal how global political and powerful elites use offshore tax havens to hide their wealth and cover up their shady dealings. Let's turn to Panama Papers. Your news organization, as I said, was one of more than 100 media organizations from 80 countries and one of the six media outlets in the Middle East and North Africa that collaborated in the year-long massive investigation into offshore tax havens. How did you start your collaboration with Investigative Consortium of Journalists, ICIJ, that let the investigation come about?
Actually, we are not new in the field because we worked with the ICIG on the Swift Leaks more than a year ago. The ICIG got in touch with us back in the time to have a partner on the Arab world, and they asked us to work on the Swift Leaks for the Tunisian folder. So that's how we got involved at the first time. And then when they got in touch the second time, about the Panama Papers, of course, we said yes a second time because it's a huge adventure. It's a really professional way and innovative way to work as journalists. We love it. We think it's the future of the field to work on a collaborative way to help each other and to make big waves. Not being alone in his on his own side, you know, not running after a buzz by ourselves, but being linked with others and working in a big solidarity movement. That's why we got involved again.
Did you know from the beginning that there were other media organizations from the Middle East and North Africa are going to be involved in this year-long investigation?
Yes, you know, the way to work is really transparent. So from the beginning, we know that there are plenty of journalists and plenty of media outlets. And for us, it's a good thing. When we've done the Swiss Leaks, it was strong investigation because we were plenty. And it's good to know that there are other outlets, media outlets in the Arab world covering the issue.
There were news organizations from Egypt, Iraq, Jordan, Algeria, Yemen, and also, of course, Tunisia were involved pouring over and sifting through 11.5 million pages of documents. From what's been reported, 20 to 40 Tunisian names appear in the leaked documents. They include politicians, lawyers, and media moguls. This year-long project, as I said, you sifted through millions of documents. How big of a task was it to find relevant names of individuals or companies from Tunisia? Their relationship with Mossack Fonseca, the Panamanian law firm, which is at the center of this investigation?
It's a world that asks a lot of commitment. It takes time. That's why all those months of work were mandatory. That's not an investigation that you can do in 2 or 3 weeks, for sure. It asks to know the field. We were two working on digging into the folders and the files. and we complete each other because obviously each of us has his own knowledge about the Tunisian political and financial caste. And therefore, when you go through it, you can see names popping. Tunisia is not involved as other countries where you have hundreds or thousands of names, because Tunisia is a small country, so obviously it's not big amount of names.
But there is quite a long list of Arab leaders, former and current, that are implicated as the result of the investigation, and also there are a few Iranian names and companies in the documents.
Yes, but obviously we were only looking for the Tunisian ones. That's what we've been involved to work on the Tunisian ground. There's no point for none of us to work on a country that someone else is covering, and for sure they'll be covering it better than us because they are from this country. So for us, I think that if we are the ones working in Tunisia, for sure we will know more than someone working, I don't know, from Brazil trying to cover Tunisia.
Yeah.
So I think that's why it's a nice thing. It's good, it's efficient to be that many numbers of journalists, because it really helps you to make appropriate work on appropriate names from your country. And it makes it really relevant for the reader, because you know what you are speaking about. You know your field. I think that's why also a leak like that needs to be done by a big number of journalists. We saw it for Morocco, for example, that journalists who tried to get answer back on Morocco end up with answer saying, but you are foreigners. Why should we answer back to you? Well, when you are on the ground and from the country, I think at some point it forced the people involved to answer back.
And also Mike Hudson, a senior editor at ICIJ, said exactly what you're saying, that they really benefited from the local knowledge that many journalists had in sifting through these documents. You just put in, for example, Tunisia in the search engine and you came up with relevant documents?
Yes, but not only. Yes, that's a way, yes. But as Tunisia is a small country, we know that it's always the same thing who comes back. It's a small country, so you know that it's a small caste who is involved, who has been involved before and is still involved today. And it's only a few families who are holding the main business. So therefore, you know that some names may pop up, because you know which field you have to look for. I mean, in Tunisia, we don't have gold, so you're never going to go and look for something around gold. But obviously, we have oil, so you can still look for something around oil. And it's not only about the country. It's also about the names of the company or the field that is strong in your country.
So there are not very many surprises there. A few hours after the publication of the Panama Papers, your website was hacked. The hackers replaced some of the content with wrong information. You posted on your Facebook and your Twitter feed, the site has suffered a set of violent and continuous attacks. As a result, our technical team have decided to close access to the site pending resolving technical problems. From what I know, your site is the only site that has been hacked.
Yes.
So what happened?
What happened is that as soon as we released the first article, the website is getting really slow and we have trouble accessing it again. And so an attack is being launched, and it was ongoing for a few days. And so the hackers went into the website and changed the name. That was on the second article. They changed the name of the person supposedly involved, and they replaced the name by the name of the president who was elected just after the revolution.
So they replaced the name of Mohsen Marzouk, former Secretary General of NIDA Tunis and one of the most powerful political figures in Tunisia, with Monsef Marzouki, the former president.
Yes, exactly. So that first thing is, it's a weird way to do, They wrote to change the narrative, so they're trying to grab the attention on someone else. And then we decided to suspend it for a while because there was beginning to be an intense situation. And then we have journalists and media releasing articles with names that we never spoke about, pretending that we've done it. And for me, there are two things in this attack. First of all, they're trying to change the narrative. And second of all, what I understand from that is that if the story wasn't good, it would have gone with the flow. Instead of what someone or maybe an entity, I still don't know, tried to hack the website and make the information disappear. And I'm wondering, when you know that 100 outlets around the world and 400 journalists are working on the same issue, how could you think 1 minute that the story will fade away? How could they think that by shutting down Intifada, the story will fade out? There's something here that I don't understand and makes me wonder who can be doing that. It's something that reminds me about what authoritarian regimes do, actually. So I'm wondering what's the point in this whole hacking adventure, let's say. Also, if there's nothing to hide and if everything is wrong in what we've wrote, it's not a big deal. You just go defend yourself and that's it. But it ends up making the story even bigger, which is the opposite of what I'm sure the hacker wanted to do.
Mr. Marzouk contacted Mossack Fonseca in 2014. This happened while he was the campaign manager of President Essebsi, and he wanted to explore the possibility of opening an offshore company. What happened after that, after his initial attempts to try to open this offshore shell company?
We don't know. We tried to get in touch to make sure about the whole story, but Mr. Marzouk never came back to us, even though we tried to contact him by phone calls, text message, email, Facebook, through people close to him. So we don't know. And as we want to do our job properly, we're still open to have answers and, of course, to make the article more complete by adding his answer. So he's still more than welcome to answer back.
But Sana, he has threatened to take you to court.
Yes.
So apparently he really is not interested in talking to you.
Yes, he wants to take us to court. And the thing here that annoys me around the trial, it's the nasty game who is being played. Because facing a trial for journalists, it's not a big deal. But the thing is that they're trying to change again the narrative.
And they're probably also trying to send a message to other journalists in Tunisia, Tunisian journalists elsewhere, that if you touch the government or expose any of their wrongdoings, they are going to hear from them and they have to basically bear the consequences of their exposés and investigations.
Yes, but we are ready to face the consequences of our work, but we want to play it by the rules, which means that if we have to be judged, we want to be judged regarding the laws of the press code, because we are journalists. And now there is this whole nasty game about changing the narrative, pretending that nobody knows about Intifada in Tunisia, and we are not journalists. And therefore, they may try to sue us regarding the penal code, so the penal laws, which don't apply for journalists. And what they are trying to do, what happened after we released, was this whole campaign, this bashing campaign, saying that we are not journalists, nobody knows about us in Tunisia, we are not registered, we don't have press cards, we are not professional. And what we are saying is all wrong. We never tried to get in touch with Mr. Marzouk. And that's what's annoying me. But at the same time, it shows up big questions about what's happening.
Who has tried to question your professionalism and your journalism? other media outlets or political figures?
So we had the hacking, and then we had the trolls on the whole Facebook, on Twitter, through email, people launching discussion and questioning, which is good, which is what it's supposed to be. I mean, when you write something, you are expecting people to be pro and people to be against. That's normal. That's life. You write to make sure that there's going to be a debate in the society. The staff of Intifada was in the press room the days after the publication, were assaulted almost and harassed physically. There was this violent wave coming to us. Our colleagues in the office were almost harassed by people who wanted to know not the in and out of the article, but they wanted to know how did we get the names? Why are we involved? Where do we take our money from? To whom we are linked? Are we sent by, I don't know, which kind of intelligence from which kind of country? We end up now with articles saying that we are linked to foreign intelligence. We end up with posts on Facebook and articles saying that we belong to that country or that country, and that we're taking money from outside to make I don't know what. So at least at the beginning, there were no coverage about what's going on and what is the Panama Papers about. It was more about who we are and what we've been doing. And for me, that's linked with the hacking of the website. Because if for 5 minutes, people have switched on their TV on another channel somewhere else in the world, or another newspaper, another radio, they could have understood that it's a big project. Panama Papers have been, it's an investigation who went for numbers of months through the whole world. So there's no way that a media who is involved is going to be paid by an intelligence services somewhere in the world. It just doesn't make sense. So I'm wondering how they could come to us and be so violent in the way, in their reaction. That was really a really weird impact of
so,
our work, actually.
Sana, were you surprised that you were getting such violent, as you call it, and harsh criticism and reactions to your reports?
Yes, we were surprised, because it's not the first time we're doing investigation. Mm. We were surprised to have our colleagues threatened or to have our colleagues harassed, because we are not used to that. We are used to do investigation. It's not the first time we're doing it. We're working as a team since almost 5 years now. So we've been working for a long time together. We never expect that. I never expected that strong wave of violence. But at the same time, I have to enforce also the fact that we are having a lot of support also by everyday people, by readers, by people who didn't have a clue about who we were and are supporting us. So you can see that everyday people do care about what's happening. But at the same time, you can see that there is something in the violent answer. There is something who, for me, it's a manipulation. There's no way people could be that violent if there's not a purpose. Because I can't figure out how that many people will post that kind of harsh comments and be that violent with us if there's not something made up at the back of that.
Intifada has been working with the investigative journalism outlet ANSIR, African Network of Centers for Investigative Reporting, to report all the information related to Tunisia. And when your website was hacked, they actually carried the reports and articles on their website, even though people could not access it through your website. Why did you decide to team up with them? Is that to protect yourself from what might come after you publish these
no,
leaks?
ANSIR was on board since the beginning with ICIG. They were on board since the beginning, and it's really good because they're working about African issues, which is really good for us because, of course, they know how it's going on in the continent. They know what we may face as journalists when we are trying to tackle this kind of big issues around finance and economy, oil, mines, human trafficking. They know they were involved since the beginning with ICIG and the German newspaper, but they released the articles of all the African outlets. And of course, they made publicity around that. They say that the articles of Intifada, it can be read on their website, which is really nice from them, because I was so scared that their website will be hacked too. Mm. That was my concern, you know. But they offer more than that. They offer us to help us on security, on reinforcing the website, offering parallel ways to make sure the website will still go on. It's not only about publishing our work, it's all the IT and technical support they're also giving us.
You spoke a little bit about some of the harassments and criticism you've been getting from some of your colleagues inside Tunisia. But what has been the overall coverage of the leaks and the documents and the fact that some figures in Tunisia have been implicated by these leaks?
At the beginning, the coverage was flawed. I mean, the main issue about the offshore society and money laundering was fueled by the fact that all journalists just wanted to know what's happening, what are the names. People were asking us to drop names, to drop lists. It doesn't make any sense. Journalists, they were expecting us just to drop a list of names as if we were police or judges. There was this anger because we didn't release names. It's not our job. We're not here to do that.
But you are going to. From what I understand, there are going to be more names coming out.
Yes, there are going to be more articles coming out, but there will never be a list of names because it's pointless. What we're trying to do is to analyze the documents and to give a voice to the person who is involved also, because everyone who is named somewhere has the right to defend himself and to give his own view of the story. And that's what we're trying to do. That's why it takes time. In Tunisia, people were so excited about having names out of the blue, no matter if people are involved in something or not, if it's legal or illegal, people just wanted names.
But part of this investigation, Sana, hasn't been about really exposing people who have tried to dodge paying taxes, or they have basically robbed the treasury of people, of Tunisia, for example, to stash their money, millions of dollars, probably, somewhere else in Panama or British Virgin Islands.
I think that, first of all, I'm not a judge. It's not on me to say who is guilty and who is not.
For example, with Mohsen Marzouk, you called him and asked him about your findings. And he did not respond.
Yes, but
you eventually decided to publish his name and make his name public. Is that the same sort of standard that you're going to be using with other people whose name have appeared in these documents?
The thing is that other people are answering back. I think that the main question is about, is there an interest for the public? Is there an interest for the public to know? Maybe the person was living abroad and everything is fine and there's nothing to be said. Maybe the person was living in Tunisia and is tricking the law and there's something wrong. So each case is different and therefore we have to look at it in that way. If we just drop names, but maybe the person is not doing something illegal and it's their personal data, do I have to let that out? Even though there's no public interest in this story? Is it just throwing names of people on the public plate to have them defamated? That's the whole difficulty here. It's about balancing and really having something to speak about and who is in the public interest to be known.
At the same time that you don't want to be the judge and the jury, journalists are making this decision and this judgment of what it is in the public interest and what it is not in the public interest to publish. So we are basically exercising a degree of judgment here, right?
Yes, but also I'm not saying that this person is guilty and this one is not. What I'm saying is that in Tunisia, that small nuances wasn't that clear. That's why when people were asking us for names, It's as if we're going to make a public trial for those persons.
Recently, the Moez Jaoudi, I believe, president of the Tunisian Association for Governors, told the national television station in Tunisia that Tunisia itself is a tax haven, with 54% of the national economy escaping state control. And the head of the Tunisia Labor Union, the secretary of UGDT, Samir Shefi, also said that Tunisia has among the highest rates of tax fraud in the world.
Actually, what those two men say is true, and it's even a joke that we are making in Tunisia. Anyways, who's paying his tax? You know, we need to tackle that in a serious way. We're missing money. It's not as if Tunisia was healthy and the money was floating, it was raining everywhere. We have trouble now with tourism, which is a big part of the GDP, because tourism has been tackled so much with the terrorism. So we really need to look at and tackle that problem of taxes. And of course, it's not the few names that will solve the whole problem of the tax system in Tunisia. And we can see that the tax are not well collected, because obviously the schools are missing everything. The hospital, the public hospital, there's a lot of things missing inside. The public system is not going properly as it should be. It's not efficient enough to really answer to the needs of the citizen. I think it's something we really need to tackle. So those Panama Papers, those stories around that, it's just the head of the iceberg, may I say, what we need to tackle and what we need to change in the way the system is going.
The reactions to the publication of the Panama Papers have varied widely around the world. China has blocked any news and reporting on the leaked documents. Russia has called them an anti-Putin propaganda directed by the U.S. But in Iceland, the prime minister resigned. The head of the Chile office of the corruption watchdog group Transparency International has resigned after his name appeared in the data leak. And the reverberations of the report are felt in countries across the world. What about in the Middle East and North Africa, where there is direct state control or censorship of media, coupled with the fact that ordinary people across the region, from Iran to Morocco, know how corrupt their governments are?
So few days after we released the first article about the Panama Papers, there were a call for a commission to be set up in the parliament to do an inquiry around what was going to come out of the Panama Papers. I think it's something really important. It means that Tunisia is going with some baby steps, but we are going on a more democratical, with more transparency. We're going toward that. It's something who make me feel really happy and relief. Of course, we know how the corruption is going in Tunisia. We can see it in every corner of every street. We know that there is corruption everywhere. It's the whole system. But knowing that there was more than 100 deputies who asked through a petition that a commission in the parliament was set up to look and do an inquiry around that question was something really positive, I think, because it means that there are people who care about what's happening and that we are trying to work on changing the mentalities. I hope that it's going to shake the way we think about tax and about the public system. I hope that something is going to swap here and we're going to understand that something which is public belongs to everyone. A public school belongs to all the cities, and therefore paying tax can help you to build something that we have in common.
Because in 2015, the publication of the first part of your investigation of the Tunisian listings of SwissLeaks scandal led the prosecutors in Tunisia to open an investigation for money laundering against all the people that their names were in the HSBC bank account. But that investigation did not get anywhere. from what I understand. So do you think this time it's going to be different?
I don't know, but again, for me, it's more about putting something on a public debate.
Mm-hmm.
Intifada, it's about looking in the corners that nobody looks, and it's trying to change the way we think. For me, it's more about trying to change the look that we have on those questions, and also trying to show that this political and financial caste that was here before is not present. Because even though the head of state went, the system is still here. It's something bigger that we need to change. So for me, it's like a reminder. Democracy is not settled yet, and it's never going to be established if we don't care about it every day.
Sana Spawi is a journalist and chief editor of the French edition of Intifada, an independent reporting news site that covers issues affecting people in Tunisia. Sana covers social and economic justice issues, migration, and media. Intifada is one of the 100 media organizations from more than 80 countries around the world that poured over 11.5 million files that reveal how global political and powerful elites use offshore tax havens to hide their wealth and cover up their shady dealings. From Pacifica Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. Last year, over 1,100 black activists, artists, students, and scholars, including Angela Davis, Cornel West, and Mumia Abu-Jamal, signed the Black Solidarity Statement with Palestine. Next, Womina contributor Josh Wilner looks at the Solidarity Statement with one of its authors, Khoury Peterson-Smith, and Palestinian rights activist Yoel Haile.
Them, I see us.
Every 28 hours, a black life is stolen by police or vigilantes in the U.S.
Every 2 hours, a Palestinian child was killed in Israel's attack on Gaza last summer.
On August 18th, 2015, Ebony Magazine published an article titled, 1,000 Black Activists, Artists, and Scholars Demand Justice for Palestine. This headline-grabbing piece referred to a statement expressing the black community's solidarity with the Palestinian freedom struggle.
The summer 2014 was when Israel was laying siege to Gaza in its latest assault on Palestine, and it also was the same summer of the Ferguson uprising. You know, you have this catastrophic attack on Gaza, over 1,000 Palestinians killed, but hundreds and hundreds of children. And then you have Ferguson rise up in rebellion against racism in the United States. And when that rebellion happened, there were not only messages of solidarity from Palestinians on Twitter, but also there were two statements of solidarity from Palestinian organizations supporting the Ferguson uprising, which was really amazing. And Christian and I noted that there hadn't been a corresponding statement in the other direction of black folks here in solidarity with the Palestinian struggle, even though there had actually been a growing kind of sense of solidarity.
Eric Garner, 43 years old, father of six, grandfather, friend.
Ghalia Al-Ghannam, 7 years old, killed when an Israeli missile struck her home.
Hashim Abu Maria, 45 years old, father of four, human rights worker.
Ayanna Jones, 7 years old, killed in her sleep by Detroit police.
When I see them, I see us.
Kari Peterson-Smith, one of the authors of the Solidarity Statement, believes the statement was a result of the growing connection between the American black freedom struggle and the movement for a free Palestine.
And so we revisited the statement in 2015, and it's actually really fortuitous that it took us a year, because in that year's time, not only was there the reemergence of a black struggle in this country that I think has totally changed the conversation around racism in the United States and, frankly, beyond the United States, but also there's been all these opportunities for black Palestine solidarity. There were Palestinians on the ground in Ferguson during that uprising. There were delegations of Black Lives Matter-oriented organizations in this country to Palestine in that intervening year. And so when we went ahead and put the statement out there, it was really successful, and people like Angela Davis and Mumia Abu-Jamal and Talib Kweli and Cornel West and Alice Walker and others signed on to it.
I want to talk a little more about connecting systems of oppression. Here's a quote from your statement. Quote, Israel's widespread use of detention and imprisonment against Palestinians evokes the mass incarceration of black people in the U.S., including the political imprisonment of our own revolutionaries. Soldiers, police, and courts justify lethal force against us and our children, who pose no imminent threat. And while the U.S. and Israel would continue to oppress us without collaborating with each other, we have witnessed police and soldiers from the two countries train side by side.
Again, going back to the summer of 2014, there are all of these very visual images of both oppression and resistance in Palestine and against black people in the United States that, just looking at them, were unmistakably evoking each other. One of the most striking images of that attack in 2014 on Gaza that I remember was as Israel was bombing Gaza, both from aircraft and launching their own missiles into the territory, Israelis in southern Israel would gather on lawn chairs and they would watch and they would cheer as bombs exploded. And it unmistakably evoked the experience of white racists gathering as spectators to lynching of black people at the height of lynching in the 19th and 20th centuries.
The statement also points out the ongoing collaboration between American police departments and Israeli occupation forces.
Urban police departments across this country train with Israel, which brands itself, Israel brands itself as this place of expertise for so-called security issues and dealing with so-called terrorism, which in reality is using violence to manage an oppressed population. It's not accidental that there's collaboration between these two countries, or that there are particular corporations like G4S that we name in the statement, which is a so-called security corporation that runs prisons and does all kinds of other so-called security contracting in Israel and also in the United States.
The Black and Palestinian freedom movements have a long history of cooperation. Yoel Haile, political director of the African Black Coalition, a black youth organization currently encompassing the black student unions at 16 university campuses in California, talks about this history.
The black radical tradition at its core is anti-oppression, and we've had material connections between both movements, liberation movements, going all the way back to the 60s. The Black Panther Party used to have a working partnership with the Popular Front for Palestinian Liberation. Many of the African liberation movements were an active partnerships with the PLO and with the Popular Front.
There's something really exciting about what feels like a new chapter of Black Palestine solidarity at the moment, but we should understand that it's one chapter in a long book, that we're revisiting a history that already existed. There's a history, particularly in the 1960s, of Black Palestine solidarity that I'm really excited that there's kind of a new, latest iteration of.
They are both struggles against colonialism and against imperialism, particularly British and U.S. imperialism that led to the creation of the State of Israel as it currently stands. Both peoples across the diaspora have worked together in many instances historically, primarily because we have the same enemies. We have the same forces and systems that are working to dispossess us of our land and subjugate us perpetually. So in resistance to that, it is only natural that we ally ourselves together against our common enemies.
More recently, the Bay Area has seen several acts of solidarity since the beginning of the Black Lives Matter movement, from Black activists like Angela Davis bringing Palestinian liberation into the conversation of Black liberation, to protesters waving a Palestinian flag as they blocked the San Mateo Bridge on Martin Luther King Day in 2014. But at the UC Board of Regents meeting on March 23rd, a statement of principles against intolerance was put forward, which explicitly conflated anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism.
The African Black Coalition knows that the UC Regents were drafting a statement of intolerance that in many ways was prompted by lobbying that came from the Zionist camp directed at the Regents, urging the Regents to take harsher stances on Palestine solidarity activism, and informed by those claims and by that lobbying effort, we knew that the Regents were drafting a statement of intolerance. And we've been monitoring it carefully. When we saw that three out of the four consultants that were brought in were essentially open and avid Zionists, we knew that the direction it was going was not going towards the true statement of intolerance. And the statement itself, once it came out, it wasn't satisfactory to us, but it was also the background information that the Regents put on was highly alarming for us, because there was a clear conflation of anti-Semitism with anti-Zionism, which we completely reject and do not accept.
In response to pressure from student, faculty, and community groups, the statement was amended to condemn, quote, anti-Semitic forms of Zionism, end quote.
But it's still unclear to me or to anybody else what exactly anti-Semitic versions of anti-Zionism mean. That has to be spelled out, because if you're anti-Semitic, you're anti-Semitic, whether you're anti-Zionist or pro-Zionist, it doesn't matter. And if you're not anti-Semitic, you're not anti-Semitic. So it's very unclear what it means to have somebody who is anti-Zionist and anti-Semitic at the same time. They're unclear as to how to enforce it, because even within the UC lawyers, essentially, there's conflicting opinions about whether or not this statement of intolerance, as it was currently written, can be enforced, and in what way can it be enforced without infringing upon First Amendment rights. It exposed the farce about a statement of intolerance that is not inclusive in its own construction and in its own design. You know, every story has two sides. This particular issue, even if they wanted to focus on Israel-Palestine, no expert on the issue of Palestinians or the Israeli-Palestine conflict representing the Palestinian side was consulted or even brought on. It was two Zionists who have a vested interest in making sure Israel is not punished for what it does wrong, but also not even criticized, let alone punished, just even criticized.
But despite all the attacks on Palestinian justice organizing on campuses, activists involved in both movements say there's much to be hopeful about.
This is actually part of a globally coordinated response to what has actually been success. That's why we face real difficulties, but I am very hopeful about where we're at in the Palestine solidarity struggle and the Black Lives Matter movement, because in both cases, in the realm of ideas, we're scoring major victories. We have reframed the conversation around Palestine so it's on our terms. I have to say that in Palestine at the moment, the situation's really rough. That'll change. It won't be like that forever, but it's a rough situation. Outside of Palestine, I think that we are winning in a lot of ways. The propaganda war, Israel is losing. And it's in response to those victories on our side that they are launching a counteroffensive on BDS. And that's what Obama signing that legislation is related to. And that's what the attacks on SJPs at different schools is related to. So I think the challenge for us will be when you're embattled, you can lose sight of the good things that you've achieved. We should recognize the embattlement as a response to our success and then be inspired to go forward. That is not kind of retreat into our own, but rather continue to build those bridges, continue to make the connections. This is an election year where Donald Trump is talking about building a wall to keep out migrants from Latin America. That is outrage many people in this country, which is good. And we should say you should be outraged. There should be no walls on the U.S.-Mexico border. And by the way, there should be no walls in Palestine either. I want to talk to you about that, too.
When I see them, I see us.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
TUC Radio.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Chernobyl, 30 years later. Lucas Higson's diary. In September 2015, a next-generation nuclear field engineer from Chicago went to Chernobyl. He joined the 3,500 workers on site. They are completing the largest movable structure humans have ever built, tall enough to enclose the Statue of Liberty and wide enough to cover the exploded Unit 4 of the Chernobyl power plant, including the sarcophagus that was built over the plant in 1986. Bechtel Corporation, the lead contractor, says the $1.3 billion structure will keep water out and radioactive dust and debris in for at least a century. Radiation levels in some locations are still high enough to cause premature failure of structural materials. The gigantic arch had to be built away from the destroyed power plant because of the high radiation levels. Plans are to move the structure in place on rails later in 2016. Lucas Higson kept a diary and took photos of his 10 days at Chernobyl. He wants us to hear this story in honor of the workers who risk their health today to prevent the spread of the enormous debris field that will remain at Chernobyl forever. Lucas Higson spoke at DePaul University Chicago at an event set up by Dave Kraft from the Nuclear Energy Information Service. Dave and NEIS want us to remember that, unlike all other accidents, nuclear disasters are never over and there's no away for radiation. As one Russian doctor put it at the 20th anniversary of Chernobyl, quote, "The accident is over. The catastrophe is just beginning." Such is the case with Fukushima as well. Here is Lucas Higson.
Good afternoon. My name is Lucas Higson, and I specialize in detecting and tracking radioactive materials as they travel through the environment. Naturally, my work takes me to contaminated sites across the world. I have published peer-reviewed studies monitoring the spread of this contamination. I've sampled at over 50 contaminated sites here in the United States, including some here in Illinois. This last September, just a few short months ago, I had the opportunity to travel to the Chernobyl nuclear power plant as part of a first-of-its-kind vocational training program. I had the opportunity to live in the worker town of Slavutich and take the train to the power plant every day with them. While I was at the plant, I had the unique opportunity to speak with the workers and the supervisors of the different programs that are taking place and really get a first-person understanding of some of the difficulties and complications of their remediation activities. It's still very hard for me to believe that 30 years after the disaster, the Chernobyl nuclear power plant still requires assistance with decommissioning, fuel recovery, and remediation activities. Until the nuclear disaster in Japan in 2011, Chernobyl was widely heralded as the worst man-made disaster in history. Even now, 30 years later, workers are still working just to mitigate the consequences, not to clean up, not to bring it back to its original pristine condition, just to lessen the consequences of this disaster. Chicago is inextricably linked to nuclear power. The world's first sustained nuclear reaction took place here under the oversight of Enrico Fermi in 1942. So I think it is important that we talk about events like Fukushima Daiichi and Chernobyl. On April 26, 1986, the Unit 4 reactor was crippled by a series of explosions that destroyed the reactor building and spewed radioactive materials into the environment. The fires on the site continued for 11 days. And on that warm spring night, the operators were running an experiment. During this experiment, the operators had difficulty maintaining the power levels in the reactor. The reactor power dipped below 30 megawatts and fell into what they call as the iodine pit, which is you have these daughter products that are preventing the neutrons from forming and multiplying and allowing you to continue operating the reactor. The reactor was entering dangerous waters when this happened, and it was becoming more difficult to control. If the operators had failed to complete the test that night, it was determined that they probably would not be able to repeat it for at least a year. So there was a lot of pressure on them to continue carrying out the operations no matter what was happening with the reactor itself. When the operators noticed that the power was surging, they hit what was called the AZ button, which is a scram button, which would insert the control rods into the reactor and stop the reaction that was taking place. No one in the room could have guessed in their wildest dreams what would have happened when they pushed that button and what the events would be set into motion. But after the button was pressed, the reactivity in the reactor accelerated out of control, leading to a prompt neutron surge that completely destroyed the reactor. When the operators realized that the control rods had not fully inserted, they began attempting any alternative method that they could think of to try and get the control rods inserted into the reactor. But all of these efforts were unsuccessful. Some of these operators, like many other of the emergency responders that night, would later die from the radiation exposures that they received. The pressure inside of the reactor increased by 15 atmospheres per second, which prevented the additional flow of water into the reactor. The reactor, instead of water, began to fill up with a mixture of radioactive gases, including hydrogen and oxygen. And within a few seconds, the powerful explosions completely crippled the reactor, destroyed the reactor building, and spread contamination around the site. The operators would die that night from the exposures without knowing exactly why the reactor blew up. Only after the accident would it be discovered that the flaw that caused this power surge was known to the designers and some of the senior technical staff, but this had never been communicated to the operators of these reactors. The explosion that night destroyed the reactor building, ripped through all of the protection barriers, and overcame all of the safety systems. It also damaged portions of the adjacent buildings, like the turbine buildings, the administrational buildings, the Unit 3 reactor building, and it left fires spread across the site. The following is a quote from Gian Petrov, who at the time was an equipment manager that supplied components to nuclear power plants in the region. On that night, he was actually driving back to Pripyat with his son at about 2:30 in the morning, which is about an hour after the accident. While approaching the city, Petrov said that he could see the fires above the Unit 4 reactor, and this is a quote from him. "The ventilation stack, with its horizontal red stripes, was clearly lit up by the flames. I remember how the flames were higher than the shaft, so that meant they must have been nearly 600 feet in the air. Instead of turning to go home, I decided to go closer to the number 4 unit to get a better look. By the light of the fire, I could see that the building was half destroyed. It was a terrible sight. I stood there about a minute, feeling a strangely oppressive sense of alarm, of numbness. Everything that I saw was imprinted on my memory for the rest of my life. I could clearly see the flames on the roofs of the turbine hall and the deaerator, and I could see the firefighters. One of these firefighters climbed onto the roof of the block. Now, sometime later, I realize he was the first person in the history of mankind to be exposed to that kind of danger. Even at Hiroshima, there was no one who got that close to the nuclear explosion. At his feet, the crater of a nuclear volcano was emitting 30,000 Rontgen per hour. Before the disaster, to kind of help put that number into perspective, it would have been unheard of for the average nuclear industry worker to be exposed to more than 5 Rontgen during an entire year of normal operations. And the specialists that go into the high radiation areas would generally only receive 10 to 15 Rontgen per year. Immediately after the disaster, the site was heavily contaminated. Fuel and graphite was spread around, and the radiation levels were critical. Most of the windows in the surrounding buildings were broken, and this glass and the building materials, nuclear fuel, and the graphite from the reactor littered the grounds. The material was collected by humans, robots, and industrial equipment. The heavy equipment was used to pile up the most contaminated of the debris and bury it in pits on site as a method of temporary storage. There wasn't enough time for them to manufacture or ship in new equipment to the site, so it wouldn't be uncommon for you to see various military vehicles like tanks running around during operations during those first few weeks. During the first 11 days, helicopters dropped over 14,000 tons of various materials, generally lead, dolomite, marble powder, sand, zeolite, anything that they could think of that would help stop the reaction from occurring. By the 11th day, the radiation releases from the reactor had dropped dramatically due to the really heroic efforts of some workers who went underneath the reactor building and were pumping liquid nitrogen, which ultimately helped to cool some of this melted nuclear fuel. The radiation that was released was in the form of radioactive gases, but it also included condensed particles and actual particles of the fuel and graphite itself. The intense heat of the core spiked to over 2,500 degrees Celsius, and it worked like a chimney here. It pushed this plume upwards thousands of feet into the atmosphere, where it traveled from that point of dispersion and spread until it was easily detected throughout the northern hemisphere, leaving behind a trail of contamination in virtually every country in both Eastern and Western Europe. For the first few months after the explosions, workers carried out just emergency operations. By mid-May, the Soviet government concluded that they needed to construct some type of structure, some type of sarcophagus that would limit the release of radionuclides into the environment and lower the exposure of these workers that were on site. The Soviet Ministry of Machine Building was the one that was assigned the task of designing this shelter. The sarcophagus was designed to prevent elements from getting into the reactor building and also to limit the things that were coming out. But it is not a closed structure. There were purposeful openings that were left to allow some gases to get out, so that way there wasn't a buildup of pressure or temperature inside of the shelter. The radiation levels on site prevented humans from doing much of the work for very long, and there's a lot of stories that you can go out and hear about some of the heroic activities of people who walked out and physically picked up this fuel and graphite despite the radiation levels. But the sarcophagus is a sort of concrete and metal pyramid. While work above the ground focused on limiting the release of radiation from the reactor building, underground, workers toiled tirelessly to dig this tunnel under the reactor. The concern was is that the melted nuclear fuels would penetrate through the reactor building into the ground, and there was some water underneath the building, and there was some concerns that this could cause an additional explosion, which would further spread the materials around the site. So these heroes, as I think of them, they toiled by hand with shovels and wheelbarrows, walking into a tunnel that looked much like a mine that went underneath this building. But the environmental conditions inside of this tunnel were beyond difficult. It was an incredible work. The construction activities, while they were taking place, they went around the clock, 24 hours a day, with about 10,000 workers on each shift. These workers cleared the debris and contaminated materials from the north side of the Unit 4 building and the east side of the Unit 3 building. And additionally, they had to decontaminate the local area, scrape topsoil, build new roads. It was a very large undertaking just to get the materials on site, let alone to construct the sarcophagus. But the completed sarcophagus is a 300,000-ton, 28-story shelter object, and it is constructed out of lead, concrete, and steel primarily, all of which is now extremely contaminated. It is important to remember that it has always been a temporary stopgap measure, not a permanent solution. So they proposed three new confinement structures: the frame, the console, and the arch. Eventually, they decided to use the arch design, although if you go back and read, there was some controversy over that selection. It is an incredibly massive structure. It's described as the largest movable structure in the history of mankind. It is large enough that the Statue of Liberty could easily fit underneath it. They plan to move this new confinement structure in place over the sarcophagus in one day. The design engineer told me that the problem would not be getting the structure to move as much as it would be getting it to stop in the right place. They needed to create the work pad not only to cut down on the dust and to reduce the worker exposures, but also to support the incredible weight of this new structure. They also have to construct special tracks which will guide the structure in place over the Unit 4. This is what the exterior of the sarcophagus looks like today. It is extremely unstable in engineering terms, experiencing accelerated decay, not only because of the environmental conditions inside, but also the intense radioactive fields. So far, we've only talked about the radioactive materials in and around the reactor building, but there are many critical issues to deal with in the adjacent areas as well. Remember, we discussed that in the early days, the workers were trying to clear the contaminated equipment and materials as quickly as possible. They weren't concerned about the long-term implications of these actions. So as a result, you're left with a bunch of contaminated equipment both above and below the surface of the ground. There's actually an interesting story. One of my friends is the supervisor who is doing some of these activities, and they were digging in an area for this trench that we talked about that will move the new confinement structure in place. And all of a sudden, these pipes came up out of the ground with the dirt that they were lifting out, and the radiation levels spiked, so they stopped work. And it ultimately ended up being some of the zirconium cladding for the fuel assemblies that they had pulled out of the ground. So this is the type of stuff that they are still finding. They don't know where all of it is. Another issue that they're going to have to deal with is the construction of storage facilities for contaminated material and nuclear waste. One thing that a lot of people don't consider is that at some point, Chernobyl will ultimately turn up into a long-term disposal facility for the radioactive materials from this accident. They will not leave the site. And I expect that this is likely the same future in some capacity that they will face in Japan as well. One of the critical issues at the power plant today is to keep worker exposures as low as possible. But if we're honest, there's only so much that can be done. We're never going to be able to fully remove the risk of working at a site like Chernobyl or Fukushima. There are multiple exposure concerns, but one of the primary ones is the spread of dust. The other risk of exposure is the gamma rays that are coming out of the sarcophagus, and it is inescapable. If you are in the vicinity, your radiation levels will be affected, determined by how far you are from that sarcophagus, what's between you. So what they have done is they have installed different types of methods of reducing this dose from the gamma shine. You'll notice these lead structures here, and this is a concrete viewing box. And what we noticed is we were able to take our equipment with us on site, and we noticed that in the immediate vicinity behind these lead shields, it offered about a 50% reduction in the gamma shine. And let's talk about the cooling pond. Before the disaster, the 2.5-mile-long cooling pond at the Chernobyl nuclear power plant was a popular fishing spot and supported a large fish farm. You can actually see the cooling pond from space. This cooling pond was heavily contaminated during the disaster, and pieces of nuclear fuel were directly introduced into it. Water from the underground compartments of the reactor was directly pumped into the cooling pond by fire trucks. Additionally, they also scraped heavily contaminated soils and dumped them into certain areas of this cooling pond. And over time, the majority of these radioactive materials began to settle out and accumulate in the bottom sediments. And this is a concern, because now that there are no operating reactors at the site, there is no need for a cooling pond. It is a man-made cooling pond, and if they were not to manage the water levels, down here is the amount of water that would be left behind if they just let it be. And that would expose a large amount of these radioactive materials. This is cesium, strontium, and plutonium levels in the bottom of this cooling pond. So there is some concern about what they should do. Do we scrape everything out and allow it to dry? Do we cement? Do we put down tarps? Or do we just keep water in it? But they are experiencing some drought conditions and a lack of snowfall in the winter for the last few years that is affecting the water levels in this cooling pond. So it is becoming a much more pressing risk and concern to them. We're going to touch really quickly on the city of Pripyat, which for all intents and purposes is barely recognizable as a city anymore. We're walking down the sidewalks along one of the major streets here, and you can't see many of the structures from the street. It was a beautiful city. It was full of art. It was full of murals. It was full of beautiful painted glass, all of which today is decaying and fading. The exclusion zone around the nuclear power plant acts as a method of institutional control to prevent the public from accessing many of these most highly contaminated lands. 50% of the land in 1986 in this exclusion zone was forested, and now more than 70% of that land is forested. This is pictures from Chernobyl City, and these are some of the monuments and memorials of the disaster. One of them that was most striking to me was this avenue of signs with big red lines through the names. We would find out that these are the names of the towns in the exclusion zone that had to be permanently evacuated because of the release of radiation. And I can tell you it is very powerful to see them lined up in front of you. The contamination in these exclusion zones and areas around the nuclear power plant is very complex and challenging. It's not consistent. Radiation levels vary enormously according to where the radioactive material fell, with some parts showing radiation levels typical to what you would see here in some areas. Some parts are thousands of times higher. And I did some sampling in some of these areas that had higher levels and lower levels. And even in the lower areas where the exposure levels were lower than some areas here in the U.S., when we analyzed that soil in the lab, we were still able to find strontium and cesium and other radioactive materials in there that would be taking up into the plant life, that could be internalized by people working in that area. The major concern right now is with the forest fires that are happening in the area. It is impossible for them to remediate these forests. There have been a few attempts, but they have all failed. So the countermeasures that they have put in place is they restrict access to these areas. According to a study published in 2014 by Dr. Timothy Mousseau, decomposers and other types of insects that drive this process of decay in these forested areas have been affected by the radiation levels. And this is complicating the decay of the materials back into the soil, leading to increased fire risk. According to simulations produced by Dr. Mousseau, previous forest fires up until 2014 had re-released and redispersed approximately 8% of the radiation from the original catastrophe. I would really like to talk about the workers at Chernobyl. Today, more than 3,500 men and women who work at the Chernobyl nuclear power plant every day live here, and this is the city of Slavutich. The city of Slavutich has, I believe, between 20 and 30,000 people currently residing in it. They take these trains from the city of Slavutich, and it dead ends at the Chernobyl nuclear power plant. And as the workers leave the train, they walk through some radiation monitoring portals into their locker rooms where they change into their work clothes. But the workers at the plant today are not the same workers that were there 30 years ago. It is their children. It is their nieces, their nephews. It is the next generation which has already begun to take over a lot of these construction activities. So let's talk about what still lies in store for Chernobyl in the future. At some indeterminate point in time, the sarcophagus will need to be dismantled. As the sarcophagus ages, it changes, and it becomes more hazardous over time. As one worker told me, the sarcophagus used to be a symbol of accomplishment, but very quickly it turned into a source of concern and controversy. They're going to have to decommission the Unit 1, Unit 2, Unit 3 reactors. They're going to have to deal with the cooling pond. They're going to have to deal with the radioactive material and melted fuel inside of the Unit 4 reactor building. One of the things that people don't think about is that if you have 3,500 workers on site every day, that's a lot of laundry. And they have to do all of this laundry on site. And they sort the clothes based on the radiation levels. They process them. But this generates more waste. All of the activities seemingly produce their own type of waste, which is going to have to be dealt with at some point down the road. We are running out of time, but I want to just stop and talk to you a little bit about these workers. For me, my visit to Chernobyl, it made me more compassionate. In America, it can be hard to interact with people outside of our personal space, let alone a different country. One of the things that was impressed upon me is that the workers at Chernobyl, they are kin to us. They are friends.
Welcome back to The Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan. This week, we're very honored and lucky to have on David Talbot. David is an American progressive journalist, author, and media entrepreneur. He's a founder and former CEO and editor-in-chief of one of the first web magazines, Salon.com. Since leaving Salon, Talbot has established a reputation as a historian, working on the Kennedy assassination and other areas of hidden history. And today we're going to be talking to him about his book, The Devil's Chessboard. And it really is a fascinating interview. And this is part one, and part two will be continued next week. So stay tuned, and we'll be right back with David Talbot. David Talbot, welcome to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
Great to be here. Thank you, Cindy.
Oh, we're very excited. When I say we, me and some of my listeners, I gave them a preview that I was going to be interviewing you, and we're very excited to have you on the show this week.
Well, I have a great respect for everything you've done, so it's great to be in conversation with you.
Well, thank you. We'll talk later about a project that you're doing that I'd like to collaborate with you on for sure. But let's get into your book, The Devil's Chessboard. It is a very fascinating read. First of all, I love spy novels. I loved reading about this. And secondly, I loathe the Dulles brothers. So it was really good to read all of your scholarly research about this.
Well, I'm glad you began by mentioning the spy thrillers, which I, of course, love to read as well, whether John Le Carre or going back further, Eric Ambler or Graham Greene. I think those are my top three. But, I wanted to write this book in a way that was a page turner. I wanted to grip people from the very beginning. It is, I think in some ways the greatest spy epic of our time. The rise of this very, notorious character, Alan Dulles, who's been largely forgotten, I think, today. The name Dulles Airport, of course, is known to people, but that's named after his brother, John Foster Dulles, who was Secretary of State under Eisenhower while Dulles ran the CIA. But I wanted to bring this history to life in, I think, the most gripping way possible. So I consciously kind of adapted these sort of techniques of of spy thriller as I told the story, and so thank you for taking note of that.
And of course, a spy thriller is not complete without the women. So I do want to talk about that too, in a few more questions. But I found interesting in preparing for this interview, I watched some interviews you did about this book, or read some interviews you did about this book. And on the one you did on Democracy Now, you said that you had some interviews scheduled when it came out, and that you were bumped at the last minute. And I had this experience when my book Peace Mom was published by Atria Books, a division of Simon & Schuster. And mm-hmm. they brought me to New York. You know, they flew me to New York, and I had interviews scheduled with every morning show, all the, you know, the cable networks and things like that. And then when I got there to their offices, they said, oh, guess what? All of those were canceled. Mm-hmm. And I was already in New York. And the interesting thing is Simon & Schuster and CBS are affiliated, and they couldn't even get me on the CBS show. So talk a little bit. And Daniel Ellsberg, of course, of the Pentagon Papers, said he had the same exact experience when he published his book.
Well, absolutely. And I think, look, the people like to think that we live in this democracy where the media, of course, is open to all points of view, but it's a lie. And writers like you and I and activists again and again run up against this, particularly, I think, Cindy, on the very taboo subject of national security. There seem to be, you know, a very, I think, narrow and constricted way that the media covers these issues. And if somebody does start to break through, like you or I with a book or our activism, you know, someone gets a call at some point, a producer, an executive within one of these media companies, and they say, no, 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 you don't want this person on the air. They're trouble. And we're trouble, of course, because we're getting people to rethink the American empire, to rethink our state of permanent war, to rethink this so-called war on terror, which has been used as an excuse to rob us of our freedoms and our civil liberties and to oppress so many people around the world. And so I think, you know, the media has been very complicit with this dominant kind of Cold War at first and now war on terror policy. And they don't welcome any kind of dissent or diversity of opinion within that world. And right, same thing happened to me. I was in New York starting my tour last October for the Devil's Chessboard, which, of course, is the dark side of American intelligence. And I was scheduled to go on even Al Jazeera, for God's sake. You'd think wow. Al Jazeera would be uh-huh. a little more independent. I was literally in my publicist's car on the way to the studio in Manhattan to go on air, and my publicist got a email saying the interview was canceled. And when he asked why, the reply came back through email, politics. I mean, at least they were honest about
right,
it.
Right, right.
So who knows who called them or what, you know, happened there, but this is what happens all too frequently.
Well, it's very interesting because, of course, my book wasn't about yours, and Daniel's were about the exposing the, you know, the dark side. I don't know if there is a light side of this and of this intelligence, you know, apparatus here in the United States. But, you know, mine was just about exposing the pain of war and, you know, trying to get that message out to as many people as possible.
Well, so, as I might say, I think your story was hit a real nerve because so many families throughout this country have been touched by sadness and tragedy like you were. And I think they're very frightened of that message. You know, they want, you know, a constant stream of young men and women to be going to battle
right.
In these wars. And when families begin to question those policies and begin to question the sacrifice that they've been asked to make, then that's, of course, very threatening to people in power. So I could see why they would intervene in your case. And in my case, yeah, they don't want these questions to be raised about American intelligence, about American, you know, the military-industrial complex and the power it has over our democratic society.
What? Yes, yeah, so tied together, so intricately woven together. But talking about, you know, in my case, of course, they tried to demonize me, but there really wasn't anything that they can demonize a suburban mother about for a while. But then even you were a senior editor at Mother Jones, right?
I was, and then I founded Salon.
Right, and I read the interview that they did about your book, and I thought it was really smarmy, and I thought that opinion you got, but they called your book this very important, well-researched book with so many endnotes. They called it a doorstop, and I thought the guy was trying to, Aaron Weiner or Wiener, whatever his name is, he was trying to show you as some kind of crazy conspiracy theorist. How did you feel about that interview?
Well, I agree. I think it was snarky. You know, believe me, it's not as bad as some of the media I've gotten from people who are even more threatened. But yeah, even left-wing publications like Mother Jones, they are very concerned about not coming off as too outside the norm, you know, in terms of media. And of course, the certain subjects like the Kennedy assassination are the third rail to these people. These are often timid younger journalists, even on the left, who don't want to threaten their careers in any way or rock the boat in any way. And often they haven't done the research themselves to know, you know, some of the darker aspects of American political life or the national security world. And so they just kind of accept the conventional wisdom often. And they really are very reluctant to step outside that narrow framework. You know, I've been a journalist my entire professional career now, which is over 40 years. And I've seen this again and again. I've worked for corporate media. I've worked outside of corporate media. And I see, you know, how the pack mentality that dominates the press and the media world. And we like to think, of course, of our journalists as the brave guys like, you know, Woodward and Bernstein, which was also a lie.
Right.
You know, who the great muckrakers taking on power and so forth. But the fact is, some of the most conservative and timid people I've ever met are in the media because they're very careerist. They're very, afraid of giving up these soft, comfortable positions. And frankly, with the media industry, the jobs being cut back so much now and the newspaper industry in decline and so on, they're even more fearful and timid because there are not that many jobs to go around for journalists. So, you know, they're not the watchdogs that we would like them to be and that they're often mythologized to be.
Of course. And as you mentioned, they have complicity with this, the propaganda about the war and terror. Well, let's talk about, like, the rise of the Cold War. And I was born in the later 50s, so, you know, I'm a Cold War baby, and it seems that, of course, Dulles, his brother, John Foster, and Allen were the architects of the Cold War. I just recently finished a book by I.F. Stone about Korea, you know, the lies about Korea, and he wrote that, like, in 1952, right after, you know, during this whole exercise, but how they, you know, the media and the establishment has seamlessly kind of transformed from the Cold War and communism is our enemy to this war on terror and terrorism is our enemy, and how the Dulleses were the main architects of that.
Well, absolutely. They were, as I call Alan Dulles, he was sort of Dick Cheney on steroids.
Okay.
Because of his wide sort of connections within what C. Wright Mills, the famous sociologist, called the power elite. You know, with the Dulles brothers, you see these interlocking connections between Wall Street. They ran the biggest law firm on Wall Street, Sullivan and Cromwell, from the 1920s up through the Cold War. They also, of course, were dominant figures in Washington, playing major roles there in Republican politics and administrations. And they were connected to things like the international oil industry, where many of their clients, of course, were in the major, industries like oil and mining and so forth, which also connected them to power throughout the world. But really the story is kind of, I think the book begins with the Nazi era and shows how in many ways the Cold War came out of World War II.
Right.
Because here you have Alan Dulles, who was our top spy during World War II in continental Europe, based in Switzerland, and he's not fighting the Nazis. He's collaborating with the Nazis for most of his time in Switzerland during the war. He's meeting secretly with high-level representatives of the Hitler regime against the policy, against the stated policy of Franklin Roosevelt, who's called for unconditional surrender, the complete crushing of the Third Reich. But Alan Dulles doesn't get the memo, so to speak. He's in defiance of FDR. He's meeting with Hitler's representatives. And what is he trying to do? He's trying to ensure that without Hitler, because he knew Hitler had to go, but without Hitler, that a large block of the Third Reich will be allowed to stay intact after World War II and continue to form a strong bulwark against the Soviet Union, which was always the Dulles brothers' main enemy. Because ideologically, of course, they represent international capitalism, corporate capitalism, and the Soviet Union was their ideological foe as the bastion of communism. So they knew they could do business with Nazi Germans. In fact, they did do business with the Nazi Germans before, during, and after the war. Some of their major clients, their law firm, were notorious companies like IG Farben that produced Zyklon B, the gas that was used to murder millions of Jews in the concentration camps. And they were continuing to exchange, cheery Christmas cards with the heads of IG Farben and some of the other more notorious Nazi industrialists and bankers throughout the war. So this is a history that's been suppressed. We don't like to think of some of our top people in American business and in American politics associating with these war criminals. But the fact is, Dulles not only associated with them, he protected them as the war came to an end. He made sure that many of these top Nazis were able to escape through the so-called Nazi rat lines, that these escape routes that ran over the Swiss Alps and down through Italy and then overseas. And in fact, he installed in power one of the top Nazis after the war in democratic West Germany. The top spy, the top intelligence official in West Germany was a man named Reinhard Gehlen, who was a blood-spattered chief of intelligence for Hitler on the Eastern Front during the war. And Dulles rehabilitated him and turned him into a great ally of ours during the Cold War.
Well, and this was, and that was my first question after the media question. I'm glad you are so experienced at this. It was Operation Sunshine that he was involved in?
Sunrise,
okay, that he was involved in.
Yeah, and in some ways, this is the seeds, the original sort of genesis of the Cold War. So what happens again in the final months of the war is Alan Dulles, again in defiance of FDR and his policy of unconditional surrender, it begins to negotiate with Nazi forces in Italy because he's very concerned that the Red Army, that the Russian army, which has taken the brunt of the fighting, of course, and are the real heroes of World War II, will start to come down through southern Europe, through the Balkans into Italy. And he knows that there's a strong left, a domestic left in Italy, because much of the resistance against fascism in Italy was led by, of course, the Communist Party and the left in Italy. So, he's afraid of Italy going to the left after the war. So what he does is he cuts a deal with the Nazi forces, Karl Wolf, who's the head of the SS and the security forces in Italy. And under the sort of deal there that he cuts, people like Karl Wolf, who as one of the top Nazis, really, he was the main link between Hitler and Himmler, the head of the SS, which ran, of course, the vast empire of concentration camps and the killing squads and so on. He lets him off the hook in return for really a surrender that had very little strategic value. The surrender was concluded in the final days, literally just days of the war. It didn't really save any lives. Its main purpose, as I say, was to forestall the Soviet Union's advance into Italy and And as a result, Carl Wolf and a number of other notorious war criminals who were allied with Wolf were allowed to escape justice. In the case of people like Reinhard Gehlen, you know, were even brought to this country where they were taken around to the, in Galen's case, he and his aide were taken to watch the World Series game in 1951 where the Yankees played the Giants. There they are sitting among all these New Yorkers, many of whom probably had loved ones who perished in the Holocaust in Europe.
Right.
And these two Nazis are there sitting hot dogs and watching Joe DiMaggio play against Willie Mays in that legendary World Series. So, you know, the CIA under Dulles feted these Nazis. It put them in power, and it used them in their war against the Soviet Union.
Right. And then the seeds of Cold War were sown. When I was reading that, it just struck me that IG Farben, their building was the only one that wasn't bombed, and that's where the I don't know what you want to call it, provisional authority or whatever, took up their offices and stuff. I was wondering if that was a coincidence that IG Farben was the only building that wasn't demolished.
No, I think it was a strategic decision that was made because they clearly thought it would be a suitable headquarters for, as you say, the Allied military command after the war. And so you see it. These pictures are very haunting. This, you know, palatial sort of corporate headquarters sitting among sort of this field of rubble and ruin bombed at Berlin.
Yeah, just evil. So, of course, this is just an hour interview, and we can't get into everything, unfortunately, that you cover. But one of, I think, a very compelling chapter was the one when you talk about how Dulles's, Alan Dulles's wife and mistress were both seeing Jung, and Jung was very interested in talking to them to get to the bottom of this person, Alan Dulles. And I thought it was very compelling that the ladies got together and called him the shark. So this was a very interesting chapter. And how did you come to include it and make it this, you know, important part of the book?
Well, fortunately, I was able to meet and spend quite a bit of time with Joan Dulles, or Tally is her married name,
mm-hmm.
who was one of Alan and Clover Dulles's daughters. And Joan, by the time I found her and connected with her, was a retired Jungian therapist herself living mm-hmm. In Santa Fe. I feel that she wanted to get as far away from the world of Washington power as she could, that she'd grown up in. So she ended up becoming, I think, kind of a seeker of the truth, of wisdom, someone who was trying to make sense of this tumultuous life that she'd come from, this life of shadow and mystery and power. And so my conversations with Joan really opened up a lot of insights for me into Alan Dulles as her father's psychology and into that world. She found him a very odd character, a very remote figure, someone who's almost like a guest in his own home. Had no real interest in his children, his two daughters and his son, his namesake, Alan Jr. Even after Alan, who was a very exceptionally bright young man, Alan Jr., came back from the Korean War with a terrible head wound and was never really the same. There was no real, you know, feeling of compassion or understanding for what his children were going through. He would never ask them about what they were doing in school or so on. She called him a kind of a benign but remote presence in the house. I began to feel, as she talked about him, and certainly in his relations with others, even his wife Clover and his mistress, and by the way, she was the one, Joan, who gave me access to those diaries and journals of his wife and mistress. And they are a remarkable window into this man, who I do think was you know, what you would call a psychopath, someone who could, without any hint of feeling, send people to their death and even kind of take some pride in the fact that he had the power to do that. You know, he told his mistress at one point, Mary Bancroft, who was a very interesting and bright woman in her own right, came out of the family that ran the Wall Street Journal. And she was one of his spies in wartime Switzerland. And at one point she asked him, how do you manage to get along with these people who are clearly your enemies? And he said, well, I like to see them. They're like little mice, and I like to see them when I lure them into traps, and then I love to watch their expression as the trap breaks their little necks. And she, of course, was appalled by this, but he didn't understand why she found that so disturbing. And he, in fact, did lure these little mice, people he knew in some cases. I write about the Noel Field family. This was a family of Quakers, of do-gooders, of people who were trying to, bring peace to the world. And at one point, he lures Noel Field as part of a CIA kind of plot against Stalin during the Cold War. And then one by one, other members of Field's family into their doom, really behind the Iron Curtain. And it's a complicated story, but it was his way of trying to subvert Stalin in Eastern Europe. But the way he did this was to take a family who he'd known since these were children, and to sort of feed them like little mice, one by one, down the throat of the snake, Stalin. So he was capable of the most, I think, terrible forms of cruelty. He put his own wife, or he attempted to put his own wife, and he did put his own son, his brain-damaged son, in the hands of the MK Ultra scientists. These were these mad scientists and doctors who, with CIA funding, were doing unspeakable mind control experiments during the Cold War. The CIA put millions and millions of dollars into these unethical experiments involving LSD and other psychedelic drugs and different forms of torture, just to see how far a human being could be programmed or what limits they could be used. And at one point, he handed his son over to...
That's amazing to me. That's just so diabolical.
Yeah, and his son was subjected at a New York hospital to terrible... insulin overdose experiments, which produce seizures and spasms, sometimes so severe that a person's spine is cracked. And Joan, who told me this story, went to see her brother in the midst of this, and he was, of course, in great pain and agony, and he begged her to try to get him out of the hospital, and she was not able to. So this was the kind of thing that Alan Dulles was capable of.
That's just amazing. Oh, like I said, very diabolical to put your own child in the hands of monsters like that. And talk more about MKUltra.
Well, MKUltra, of course, was, supposedly triggered by our fear, the U.S. fear that our soldiers overseas in the Korean War were being captured by the Chinese and subjected to these Manchurian candidate-like brainwashing experiments. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the film The Manchurian Candidate sort of is inspired by that paranoia. It turned out that actually that was way overblown. And, in fact, the CIA's own scientists in the MKUltra program did a study on the so-called Chinese and Soviet mind control experimentations, and they were nothing. They were very limited compared to the vast experiments that the CIA itself was conducting. So, as I say, what happened was the CIA under the MK, it was codenamed MKUltra, by Dulles, they funded doctors and scientists and psychiatrists at universities and laboratories throughout the country, millions and millions of dollars throughout much of the Cold War until it was finally exposed in the 1970s by Congress. And many of these experiments, as I say, were unethical, inhumane, violated human rights law and international law, Nuremberg Code, and so on. They often took unwitting subjects, like the case at McGill University, which is one of the more notorious, under a Scottish psychiatrist named Dr. Ewan Cameron. He maintained something called the sleep room at McGill University, where patients, many of them women, suffering from sort of common neurotic disorders, postpartum depression or whatever, were taken by Cameron and put in the so-called sleep room, where they were put into sort of induced comas heavily sedated, and then they were bombarded with tape loops that were meant to erase all of their previous thoughts and thought patterns, and in the process had the effect of inducing amnesia and erasing the memory banks of many of these patients, most of whom, as I say, were women. And some of the women came out of this ordeal, weeks and weeks of this, by the way, kept in these strange, like sleep, like that's why it was called the sleep room, states, and didn't know who they were. Some reverted to being infants, couldn't use the bathroom, you know, didn't remember their own children afterwards, and so on. It was truly hideous stuff. And again, Cameron was someone who Dulles was very close to. Dulles made sure that he got funded. He'd known him since World War II. And he used him again and again for consulting about foreign leaders and how to neutralize foreign leaders like Patrice Lumumba in the Congo. And so this was not just some, you know, kind of fringe experiment that Dulles didn't know about. He was centrally involved and aware of much of what was happening under the MKUltra name. And I think probably one of the most insidious things, if that's not insidious enough, is the efforts the CIA made under the MKUltra program to create Manchurian candidates, that is, programmed assassins who could carry out the CIA sort of death assignments, murder assignments, without even knowing what they were doing.
Right.
As the film, of course, kind of made famous. And, you know, we can talk about this later if the CIA actually was able to produce a Manchurian candidate. I think they did in Los Angeles in 1968 with Bobby Kennedy and Sirhan Sirhan, but that's a whole other story.
Okay, well, hope maybe we'll have time because I do want to talk about the Kennedy assassination and how these people were involved in it. So, of course, we have... like I said, I just got a message from Skype. It said warning, my stupid Skype. It works. It's great when it works, but when it doesn't work, it sucks. So I wrote a book recently, and I just am like grabbing things out from your book and from the interviews and things that you did. I wrote a book called Revolution, A Love Story in 2010. And it was about Hugo Chavez of Venezuela and the Bolivarian Revolution. But, of course, I really couldn't talk about that without going back in the U.S., you know, the United States' treacherous meddling in Latin America. And for the book, I interviewed Gore Vidal, who was actually living in Guatemala when Arbenz was assassinated.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. And yeah, it's a very compelling interview I did with him. I didn't know it either until I was like going there to, you know, because he's a scholar. He was an acquaintance of mine. He's a very interesting man. And I wanted to talk to him about U.S. imperialism and the Monroe Doctrine. And then he starts talking to me about living, you know, he rented an old monastery or convent in Guatemala and was there when Arbenz was overthrown. But of course you can't tell the story of meddling in Latin America without United Fruit and the Dulles connection and their law firm. So please talk about that. And then it will connect to Kennedy's assassination.
Sure. Well, in some ways, the Arbenz is this glamorous couple, Acabo Arbenz and his wife Maria, who took power through election in Guatemala in the early 1950s, were the Kennedys of Guatemala, this dirt-poor country, really a medieval kind of country that was controlled by a handful of land barons and by United Fruit, this huge multinational agribusiness colossus that... obviously based in the U.S. and represented by the law firm of Sullivan and Cromwell, the Dulles Brothers law firm. And, you know, United Fruit basically controlled the economies of much of Latin America, not just the agricultural land, but often the communications infrastructure, the utilities, and so on in all of these poor countries. So they wielded enormous influence, and whenever there was any kind of labor unrest in the field or any kind of threat to their power, they were brutal in crushing it, using the local militaries and police and the CIA when necessary. And so in the case of Arbenz in Guatemala in 1954, he does begin to threaten the power of United Fruit because he, after he's elected, calls for the expropriation of unused, by the way, land that's just lying fallow but owned by United Fruit, land, and redistributing it to the, you know, very poor peasantry in that country. And of course, this was a very popular move because he's trying to his best to alleviate poverty in the country and uplift the rural poor. And, but as a result, United Fruit, of course, is irritated. The Dulles brothers get involved. They're now in power in Washington. They essentially run the Eisenhower presidency, you know, at least the foreign policy aspects of the presidency. Dulles brothers convince Eisenhower that Arbenz is a communist threat. He's a dangerous man, which is not true. He's a Democrat. He's been duly elected. And they begin to undermine his presidency by creating a rebel army and beginning to create the impression, although it wasn't really true, that there's a massive invasion underway. And Arbenz decides not to fight. He does. He decides not to stand and fight because he thinks there'll be a bloodbath.
Mm-hmm.
And so what he does under enormous pressure from his own military and from the United States is to step down, give up his power peacefully. A young Che Guevara, so not just Gore Vidal happens to be in Guatemala during this eventful time, mm-hmm. but a young Che Guevara is there. He watches this, and he actually goes to Arbenz's people and says, arm the peasants. Arm the people and let us resist, and he's ready to help lead it. But Arbenz decides not to faithfully, and of course the result is he's pushed out of power. He goes into exile, and it's a terrible exile because the CIA literally stalks him all around the world. No place really will accept him, no country. He, you know, when he does finally is allowed to come to a country, they strip him of all his rights. They say he can't speak. He has to become a non-person. And finally, in desperation, he ends up for a while in Cuba, but he's not happy there because of the restrictions on his freedom there as well. And he ends up back in Mexico in exile. And he's found dead in a scalding hot bathtub one night in Mexico City. It was called somehow a suicide, although I don't think many people get into a scalding hot bathtub to kill themselves.
Right.
But his family, of course, thinks to this day that he was murdered by the CIA. I think there's a very good chance of that because we now know from other documents that have been released that the CIA did indeed have a death list related to Guatemala and the coup. They wanted to get rid of not just Arbenz and his family, but they wanted to get rid of union leaders and journalists and anyone who was a threat to the military dictatorship that took over Guatemala and proceeded, of course, to turn it into one of the worst killing, most hideous killing fields of the 20th century. Death squads roaming the countryside, rounding up peasants and activists and union leaders and murdering them. So there's a very good chance that Jacobo Arbenz was indeed one of the victims of this CIA killing machine that I don't think has gotten its full due for how lethal it's been around the world. We know about the few leaders that supposedly they targeted because of the Church Committee hearings in Congress in the 70s, that they tried to kill Castro and Patrice Lumumba in the Congo and Diem in Vietnam. But that's just the tip of the iceberg. I think what the American people don't realize is the CIA-funded killing machine also targeted people under the radar, so-called union leaders and so on, journalists, dissidents, and many of them were indeed killed. And I think Arbenz might very well be one of the victims of the CIA killing machine.
And that was right also at this in the same time frame that Mossadegh in Iran was deposed. And from what I read, you know, not from your book, but that was like with Kermit Roosevelt, right?
That's right.
Yeah, it was like one of the very first times that they felt maybe
the nephew of Teddy.
Right. A targeted removal would be better than all out war. And so that was one of the templates, I guess, for their future misadventures.
That's right. That was their first major victory. The CIA's overthrowing a democratically elected government. Prime Minister Mossadegh, who was a very popular figure because he was, for the first time, standing up against the imperial control of his country and its resources. Its oil was virtually controlled entirely by the company that's now British Petroleum, mm-hmm. and by American oil companies. And when he begins to challenge that Western control of his nation's resources by nationalizing the local oil industry, of course, all hell breaks loose, and British intelligence and the CIA collaborate to overthrow Mossadegh, which they do, and he spends the rest of his life in under house arrest, while the Shah, of course, is reinstalled as a dictator, and we all know how that movie went. Of course, America is still paying the price for its arrogance there, and, you know, the kind of deep feelings of resentment and fury that people of Iran have against the U.S. are quite valid when you understand this history, which Bernie Sanders, to his credit, briefly alluded to during one of his debates. And, of course, the American media went, huh? And, you know, kind of made fun of him for digging up this old history. Well, it's not old history. As William Faulkner said, there's nothing past about the past. We're continued to be haunted by our history. And in fact, Americans have this terrible amnesia about their history, which makes it even worse because we're never then in the position of learning from our history.
We just as just an aside, my sister and I were watching Mysteries at the Museum yesterday. And my children, some of my children were over too. And they were talking about how during the takeover of the embassy in Iran and, you know, that uprising, how, and they made a movie about it. I forget what the movie was called.
Argo.
Yeah. And so,
which was basically a CIA fairy tale.
Absolutely. And so how this brave man got these embassy employees out of Iran and the narrator says, and they were afraid that they would be seen as CIA employees. And I just looked at my sister. I said, they probably were. You know, isn't that how the CIA, how embassies in the CIA operate in other countries most of the time?
That's right. The CIA often operates under diplomatic cover through American embassies. And you know, anyone who's not a child understands this, particularly in these countries where America is doing all its mischief. Look, Argo, by the way, is, you know, the great Hollywood liberal Ben Affleck. That was the film that he made,
right,
and won the Academy Award for. It's a complete piece of CIA mythology. Again, Hollywood does this. Zero Dark Thirty.
I was about to
outrage.
Mention Zero Dark Thirty.
Here's a movie that romanticizes or mythologizes CIA torture. A movie like American Sniper, romanticizing a psychopath who was murdered, dozens and dozens of Iranian people. Maybe some of them were militants.
Iraqi, rather.
Yeah. Thank uh-huh. you. And maybe they weren't. We'll never know. It was, you know, execution. So the CIA, in fact, operates a very big office in Hollywood because they know how important Hollywood is as a source of propaganda. And they learned their mistake from not keeping an eye on Hollywood, apparently, after Oliver Stone released his explosive film, JFK, back in 1991, mm-hmm. which, of course, pointed towards the CIA as the chief culprit in the assassination of the president. So they weren't going to let that happen again. So what they did was set up a major operation there. And now often you see on these programs, any program having to do with espionage or spies, whether it's Homeland or 24 or all those, often have an ex-CIA person involved as a consultant who's overseeing the show. And, you know, you really can't do a spy show without that kind of approval. Just like you can't get approval from the Pentagon to use, you know, war equipment or things like that, unless your script has been pre-approved by the Pentagon. So the national security state has a, you know, firm control over Hollywood and what comes out of there. I found this out similar to how you and I have been blocked by the American media. Mm-hmm. My book Brothers, which was on the Kennedy presidency and the assassination of President Kennedy, was optioned by Lionsgate, which is a major Hollywood studio. This was a few years ago. They were all set to set it up as a TV series. John Hamm at one point from Mad Men was set to play JFK. They had, you know, top screenwriters and producers lined up. And we thought we had a deal at one network after the next, but someone got a call or made a call, and suddenly the deals we thought we had disappeared overnight, literally. I'm finding this out. I think yet again with the Devil's Chessboard, great interest involved in it by Hollywood, everyone set to go, and then suddenly it evaporates. So I think the CIA still plays a very powerful and pernicious role when it comes to the entertainment industry, not just the news media.
Stay tuned for next week for part two, and I'm sorry for the abrupt ending, but I was experiencing some technical difficulties. Well, that's the soapbox for this week. I hope it fascinated you as it fascinated me. As always, I'd like to thank my engineer, Don DeBar. I'd like to thank David for giving us his time and for being so flexible and kind with the difficulties we had this week. And we will be back, like I said, next week with part two of this very fascinating interview. I'm Cindy Sheehan. You've been listening to The Soapbox. Peace out for now.